This farce. This 20th century Bastille that pretends to be a pocket democracy. Why don't you put us all into solitary confinement until you get what you're after and have done with it?
That's enough! I call this meeting to order!
Look at them. Brainwashed imbeciles. Can you laugh? Can you cry? Can you think? Is this what they did to you? Is this how they tried to break you till they got what they were after? In your heads must still be the remnant of a brain. In your hearts must still be the desire to be a human being again.
This is a most serious breach of etiquette. I'd imagine your desire to stand for election was genuine.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM politics show on Thursday, the 26th of August, 2021. And we are streaming live from a Brancaster Beach car park near Sandringham on the North Norfolk coast, and also at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review not this week's news, but why we are here are three of the common rights holders up here. That's Chris Cons, Steve Bocking and Peter Bicknell. Also, later on, he's a funeral director in Milton Keynes, and he's very, very worried about this week's ONS figures reported by Sarah Napton in the Daily Telegraph, the sixth week in succession where we've had above average deaths in Britain. The question is, why? Is it the destruction of the National Health Service, or is it the vaccine? Can we trust anyone to tell us the truth about why so many extra people are dying right now? Also, Peter in Pontefract, his staff had COVID in November 2019. All of them got over it, and he believes that T-cell immunity they have got is the best there is. No problems with the Delta variant at his company. Will Richard Tice on Talk Radio give him a chance to make his point or cut him off in mid-sentence? Also, Noah in the Bible was a conspiracy theorist until it rained. A poison death shot. That's how Dr. Vladimir Zelenko calls it. Trump's doctor describes the COVID vaccines to fellow Jews in the Israeli government. He takes them through what he believes is the biggest risk of genocide since the Holocaust. Strong words, but he's not alone. Dr. Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of HIV and AIDS, agrees an unprecedented suppression of different treatments which are available to stop people going into hospital. Psychological pressure, coercion. And now, a whistleblower says, there's already been 45,000 deaths after people taking the vaccine in the United States. Also, Dr. Carrie Madday, one of the originals from the American Frontline Doctors, looks at Human 2.0, or transhumanism, the modern version of the 20th century eugenics ideology. That is from the Nazi era, in case you don't know, creating a digital, what they call, master race. Programming humanity to become happy digital slaves and wiping out disabled people before they're ever born. That's an interesting one. That's transhumanism, or Human 2.0. And finally, the one and only Max Egan, speaking from the Brisbane Freedom Rally last weekend, Australia's outspoken tracker of the news, spells out what he believes will be a confrontation between the Australian government and the people unless their lockdowns are eased soon. But first, we're going to be looking at OurWorldBristol.com and also the Drive to Survive, which is the Gypsy, Romany and Traveller campaign to stop 300,000 or so people who live in vehicles or part of that community being turned overnight, along with their children, into criminals and having their homes confiscated by the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, an exclusive with Britain's only Gypsy, Romany broadcast journalist this week. But first, before all that, joining me are these three common rights holders. And I'm going to ask you first, Chris Cotton, since you're first in line. Thanks very much, he says. You, I believe, are the ex-chairman of the parish council here in Brancaster. We're in North Norfolk.
Yes, I was.
What is a common? This is a question for a lot of people. A common is something I think of driving across it and seeing sheep and cows. But we've got you're a common rights holder. What does that actually mean? So we're talking to Stephen Bocking. So just
the commons were given to the poor of the parish in the Enclosures Act
about 1700 and some odd. And now all of a sudden this land is the jewel in the crown of Norfolk and everybody want a cut of it.
Now, I noticed today about 12 o'clock an absolute flood of cars. Well, I say a flood, but I mean literally a great big queue of cars. Now, this is only Friday. We've got a bank holiday weekend coming here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've got no problem with the people parking on here. That's, we like to see the people. We like to see the kids enjoying themselves. The fact that the golf club claims ownership, which can be sorted out just by a stroke of a pen, they will not do it.
Well, look, one thing is a bit confusing. When we talk about common land, does that mean it's owned in common by lots of different people or what?
Common land has got common rights over it, but the land is supposed to be owned by somebody. Every common is supposed to be owned by somebody. And in this case, in my opinion, it's owned by the parish of Brancaster.
But you say in your opinion, but the National Trust have actually claimed this land there and the land registry.
Well, they did that in 2009. They claimed this CL124, and nobody knew about it. This all came out just by pure chance.
When you say CL124, what do you mean?
That's the registered common.
The common rights were there, but there was some sort of doubt about who actually owned it. The National Trust came along and said, we own it. But hang on, the National Trust can't do that. People have to gift land that they already own to the National Trust. The National Trust can't just come along, surely, and say, oh, this piece of land, which is a disputed ownership, we're having it.
Well, that's what we're trying to do for historical, from historical times. We have, the local people have said that this land, we've got the documents going back to the Enclosures Act, but we can't find justice because we ain't got no money.
Now, I'm going to get Peter Bickle on the case because I know, Peter, you have quite a lot of... I was chatting to you earlier about things like gypsy rights as well, which have been being shut out. So the idea is this whole load of people, probably thousands of people over the traditional and over the centuries and traditionally have used this land, but slowly but surely they're being shut out.
Well, yeah, because commons were meant for gypsies and travellers years ago to stop on. A week or 2 weeks, or however long, to graze the horses and somewhere to live. And they're all slowly been pushed out of everywhere in the country.
So what about specifically here? Is there anywhere that gypsies used to go that they can't go anymore? And how do they stop gypsies going there?
Well, they let it get overgrown. Then there's these landowners what do land grabs. Steal the land, enclose it, stop people using it.
Physically, there's nothing to stop the gypsies going on that land, is there?
Well, there's no amenities here no more. There's, you know, where do they get water from? That's all overgrown. They let land overgrow. They block commons off. Well, they just put barriers up like you see down here.
They're actually physically stopping gypsies moving onto the land?
Yeah, or anybody else. Anybody.
We're quite near Hunstanton, aren't we? That's just down the road. Have you got similar things going on down there and up and down the coast?
Yeah, well, there was a piece of land in... on Stanton called Gypsy Green, and they put wooden posts all the way around it to stop the travellers going on it. You know, because every year you had a group of people go on there, have a bit of a holiday, do some work, earn some money, but they stopped them.
Surely what's going on here is that really things have changed. Those people that move around, itinerant workers, they're not needed anymore.
Well, they are. They are wanted, and also people should have the freedom. They should have the freedom to do what they want.
Well, they can't, surely, they can't just park up and drive anywhere. Actually, I do happen to know in New Zealand, if you've got a camper van, you can go pretty much anywhere in your camper van and stop for the night. No one will bother you, but not round here, apparently.
Well, no, you're not supposed to stop on the side of the road for a cup of tea, are you?
You know what? I've seen lorry drivers, thousands of them every night, parking up on the side of the road.
Well, yeah, but if you've got a caravan behind your van or your truck, that's illegal to stop and sleep in that caravan on the side of the road. Now, I understand it.
Okay. Well, anyway, we have put up our tent here, our yurt, actually, in the car park at Brancaster. There are all sorts of questions about who actually owns this land underneath. I wonder, Chris, can you talk about that? Do we know?
Well, originally, the land was given to the poor of the parish under an Enclosure Act. And that has stayed more or less the same. It was done privately by Norburn Barclay. So it's a private act of Parliament. And it's been like that for, well, since 1740 or whatever the case may be. And it's only recently where people have come along and grabbed the land from the poor of the parish for their own use to claim it. And it shouldn't be allowed.
The thing is that they will say to you, well, you're not really using this land. You don't have cattle on here or anything anymore.
That is actually irrelevant. The fact that we're not using cattle at the moment is totally irrelevant. We have the right to do so if we so choose. The right cannot be taken away.
So what about, say, for example, shooting? Because we do have the nowadays. I mean, do you actually ever, do any of you do shooting around here? Any done?
Yeah, we do. We start in the 1st of September. We can come down and shoot wildfowl, which we shoot and you eat for the table.
How do you do that? Most people, if they have a dead duck, they wouldn't know what to do with it.
That's because most people are, or a lot of people are townies, and they wouldn't have a clue how to do it. When you live in the countryside, that is what you do. You go after your own game, be it rabbits, hares, pheasants, wildfowl. You take it home, you dress it out, and you cook it and eat it.
You're not what you would call a bunny lover.
Yes, I am a bunny lover, but if that means loving bunnies or having something to eat, then I will eat it.
All right. So, Stephen, what do you think about the actual rights that you've got on here? Are you actually using them, and what rights are there?
Well, we've got rights for to catch fish. We've got rights for turbary, which is grass and stuff, and all the rest of it. Reeds. We've got quite a lot of common right. Big problem here is people don't seem to understand. We, as common right holders, cannot fence a common in. The landowner has to fence against the common, and they won't do it. And if the cattle get out onto the road, that could be my family or your family or somebody else who get killed. Or, you know, that's why the cattle in here, if the fences was up, we'd have cattle on here. It's as simple as that.
So, Peter, has there been much of a conflict around this area for a while then?
Oh, yeah, this has been going on for years. That's a common right holder will not, they can't get listened to because there's a thing called snobbery, and the snobbery is just overriding the local people. The local people are being driven out of the village and being spoke down to, treated like dirt.
Well, look, Chris, one of the things in the background to all of this is the fact that you've got out there, I mean, it's a horse just coming past outside, a couple of horses actually, but you've got down here, you've got an old way of doing things and a new way of doing things, because this is a very sought after area. A lot of people, say, for example, from Suffolk and London, will look to come up here to retire and buy a very expensive house, and they won't be interested in shooting duck and chopping it in half, put it in the oven, will they?
No, they're not interested in at all in that sort of way of life. If they can pick up the phone and have a delivery of whatever they want, they would rather do that than go out and get it.
Have you seen what changes have you seen over the years since the people have been coming in and buying expensive houses around? I mean, and also the other question is, how easy is it for, you know, younger families to stay in the area?
For younger families to stay in the area is very difficult. Houses are being bought for astronomical prices, mainly as second homes and weekenders. And the locals don't even get a chance, haven't got a chance of staying in here and doing what we do. They're driven out by property prices.
Stephen, you've got a couple of big landowners. You've got the Holcombe Estate just east of us here. You've also got the golf club, but do they actually own the land? Do we know?
Well, we're still waiting to see the deeds, and we haven't had them. This could all be finished tomorrow. All we need to do is to see the deeds of the land, not the land registration, because anybody can have that. but they will not produce it.
How many years ago did the National Trust register the land?
I don't know when they...
The National Trust registered this bit, which is CL124, in 2009.
No, because there's this whole thing where they can actually claim ownership and get the deeds. I think it's called adverse possession. You know about that? After 12 years. So maybe that's this year that they will actually be able to get some deeds. The National Trust will say, now this land is ours,
yes,
officially.
Yes, but not long after 2009, the Parish Council actually put in an objection to the registration of the land. So therefore, as far as I'm concerned personally, the dispute is still open and will remain so until such a time as it's settled.
That's interesting. It's a big area as well. How many thousands of acres are there here? Because you've got two enormous commons, including Skull Island itself, out just off the coast.
This bit here is sort of 550 acres. Goldhead Island is 2,100, I believe. Then you've got all Burnham, Overy, and towards Holcombe, which is another 1,200, something like that. All in all, we've got sort of 3,500, 4,000 acres of common land to use.
How much of that has the National Trust claimed?
About 1,200 acres.
Imagine how much that's worth in terms of finance. So someone just to go along and say, I'm going to claim that land and hoping it eventually comes to them, is it actually a bit of a money spinner, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, because Salt Marsh in itself is actually worth nothing. You can't do anything with it.
The salt marshes, I've been told, are worth at least £3,000 per acre. So they have, the National Trust, I added up, has stole over £2 million worth of land.
Well, the National Trust, there was an article in The Guardian recently, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page, not only to your Facebook group, which is quite active, actually, your grapevine, you call it, and also to this article in The Guardian, Can We Trust the National Trust?
A very difficult question. I personally have got sympathy with the National Trust because they actually bought the land. When they bought the land, they bought it off a consortium who were members of the golf club, and that was all hived off before they was actually bought. So the National Trust actually bought leases on land, which, considering the land is supposed to be in Ilium, is, you know, we can't quite understand.
So, Chris, can you just tell us where people can find your group and follow what you're doing?
Yeah, they can go on the net, and if they type in Scaldhead and District Common Rightholders Association Grapevine, there they will pick up the link for all sorts of things that we are doing and what we are trying to achieve.
You've got a very active secretary, I notice. He seems to spend most of his time in libraries digging out old documents.
Yeah, he's actually very good. He's very active, and yes, he's found all sorts of stuff, which he is working on and trying to get people to get around the table and talk about it.
What sort of documents has he been digging out?
Oh, old parish records, old National Trust papers, and whatever there is relating to the common up at County Hall.
At the fundamental thing behind all of this is really this Enclosure Act. It seems to me that back in the 1700s, they laid it all out. And now people are trying to pinch bits because it's such in the dim and distant past. You earlier on were actually reading me out the beginning of that act. Can you do the same again for the listeners, just so they can hear, what does an Enclosure Act, how does it start? What does it sound like to read one?
Our particular Enclosure Act starts off, whereas belonging to the parish or town of Brancaster in the county of Norfolk, 2,100 acres, so many roods and so many perches, over and above the salt and freshwater marsh, which means the salt marsh was already in there, and so was the freshwater marsh, and we've actually got another 2,100 acres belonging to the parish somewhere, which, from the readings that I have done or been told about, have been stolen over the years ever since.
It's funny you use this word stolen, because I remember years ago, this is back in 99, the 450th anniversary of Kett's Rebellion. And this was at the height of the enclosures in the 1500s. Actually, there was much more in later years. But anyway, he was a landowner himself, Robert Kett, and all around the area, people had been privatizing or enclosing the land, and he actually agreed with the peasants. And so they agreed with him. They picked up their pitchforks. He started running the whole of Norfolk, and some say even bigger parts of East Anglia, from under an oak tree. It's now called Kett's Oak, near Norwich. And he was having them arrested and put into jail for stealing the land, which, of course, effectively they were doing, because the peasants at the time, in fact, anybody that wasn't a reasonably big landowner, wasn't even allowed to vote. So these people were basically voting through Parliament their own land, voting themselves land through Parliament, and evicting all these peasants. In fact, this also had a lot to do with the that was in 1549, but the 100 years later or so, the English Civil War, because Charles I had been fining landowners who were enclosing and kicking people off the land. Anyway, this is all the history, some of which is taught in our schools, 99% of which isn't. But poor old Robert Kett, the king sent one army against him, which the peasants drove back with their pitchforks and probably a few explosives, firearms or whatever. They managed to drive back, and so they had to gather a second force. And after about 6 weeks or so, the second force came, and poor old Robert Kett was finally arrested. In fact, they promised the peasants they were going to give them what they want. And as usual, like exactly the same as in the Peasants' Revolt, they lied, they went back, they grabbed, arrested Kett, and he was strung up and left to die. His body was left there for 2 years to as a reminder to all the peasants on the walls of Norwich Castle. But he did run Norfolk for something like 2 months from underneath an oak tree, they say.
Yeah, I did remember reading all that. What I will say is, stolen is probably the wrong word. What I would say is it was usurped by other people for their own greed, if you like, or ownership.
Robert Kett, when he was in charge of Norfolk and he had all the peasants behind him, Robert Kett was having people arrested for stealing the land.
I don't know about that one, mate. the only thing I do know is that everything was agreed to, what I can remember of it, at Norwich. All the peasants like us all went home, and then they hung, drawn and quartered poor old Kett and hung his body from the castle battlements, and he hung there for 2 years.
I know, it's pretty horrific. And in these battles over land, people do get a bit funny about land. They get very possessive, don't they? It's a bit peculiar thing in human nature. I mean, we've had a bit of a reaction here, Stephen, in the local area, just to the fact that we decided we want to turn up and put a yurt here.
Yeah.
Just tell us about what's been going on around here the last couple of weeks. It's been a bit, I mean, I keep getting phone calls saying, are you having hundreds of people coming? No, there's only 10 of us.
That's just misinformation that's been spread about by who we don't know who, you know, and all this has all gone on for what? You know, just for money, basically.
Now, there seems to be a little bit of money around here, because I've heard a rumour that maybe there's been some cameras suddenly appear on the golf club just over there pointing in this direction.
I think that's to keep an eye on the peasants. You know, that's scandalous. They waste all that money because they're afraid. All thieves are afraid. In Burnham Overy, there's 77 acres of marsh there that belong to the poor. The Overy Parish Council gave it away to Holton Estate because they all go to the same drinks parties.
But really, really, what we're talking about here, Chris, surely is it's a way of life that's going. And, you know, in a way, you're trying to cling on to something, aren't you? Which is actually there's a new way of doing things. It's all about money now.
There probably is a new way of doing things, but we are trying to keep what we have got and keep alive the old traditions and rites of this parish. And we can't do that until people start talking to us and sorting things out.
This business, what we're now talking about, is the Brancaster Commons Committee, which is supposed to oversee all this land, is virtually bankrupt. Yet at the same time, we've got this golf club, who cannot show or will not show the deeds to the land, has taken last year £82,000. And we get, the common right holders get £100 a year for a round wire fence to keep the cattle off the golf course. I have got no problem with people playing golf. I've got no problem with people with privilege. What I have a great deal of problem with is abuse of privilege, and that's what's happening here.
Pete, do you see this ending in your lifetime?
No, I don't, unless something happens, because there's a big divide throughout the whole country against the rich and the poor, which is wrong, because everybody should be equal.
I think that's really what this is about. You know, the problem with the common rights holders around here and being ignored and turning their back on you is because you're not driving a top-notch 50 grand 4x4.
Oh, yeah, we're just looked upon as the local peasants, nuisance, troublemakers and all the rest, because we're not allowed to have worse ours. Our rights have been they just try to wash them away, which is wrong. We've got a government in this country and they don't do nothing. All they do is thieve for themselves.
Yep, that's what, certainly with all these contracts for the COVID, for example. Anyway, look, Chris Cotton, former chairman of the parish council here in Brancaster. Steve Bocking, what's your role at Chakra? You're on the committee of Chakra. Peter Bickle, how would we describe you, Peter?
Well, I'm just a local peasant and a common right holder. And I come here to protect and fight for my rights, and same as other people.
Well, thanks very much for joining us live from Brancaster Car Park, with everything going past our yurt here, including a horse box there, and foals, people going off to the beach, beautiful beach. If anyone's never been up to North Norfolk, do come here, but don't necessarily come this weekend. It does get very crowded over bank holidays and things like that. But anyway, we're going to talk now to a chap, we're going to hear anyway, from a chap called Jake Bowers, Drive to Survive. It's the Gypsy, Romany and Traveller campaign to stop 300,000 people or so who live in vehicles, a part of that community, being turned overnight, along with their children, into criminals by the Home Secretary, Priti Patel. Jake explains this is a law the police chiefs don't want and that travelling people have got no intention of obeying. And Jake argues the parallels between the present Tory government and the Nazis are absolutely justified.
My name is Jake Bowers. I'm a Romany journalist and I'm a blacksmith. I come from the British Romany community, or Gypsy community, which is about 300,000 strong. But I'm one of the first people from that community ever to work as a broadcast journalist.
Now, it might sound like a silly question, Jake, but whereabouts in the country are you from and where are you? Or does it, being a gypsy, a traveller, mean that you're all over the place?
Well, I am all over the place, but not necessarily geographically. I live in Hastings in Sussex. What you find with most gypsy families is that they are kind of, they live regionally. So a lot of my family live in houses nowadays, but also on sites. All the way from Sussex down to Somerset, but with a kind of a big concentration in kind of Surrey, Hampshire, West Sussex, East Sussex.
And becoming a journalist, did you find that there was any resistance amongst the profession to someone from your community getting into the profession?
No, not really. I mean, I think one of the key things to remember with any form of freelance journalism is it's all about access and insight. And one of the first things they ever tell you when you're kind of learning to be a journalist is to write about what you know. And because I was probably one of the first people from my community to become a journalist, I found that I had an access and I had an insight which a lot of, let's just say, mainstream, what we would call gorger, non-gypsy journalists, didn't really have. A lot of the journalists that I'd worked with in places like the BBC or on newspapers are frightened to go into the gypsy community, which of course to us is quite funny, because I kind of tend to think of us as being like spiders, which is, some of us may have a nasty bite, but actually we have far more to fear from wider society than society ever has to fear from us.
Why do you say that?
Because when you have a look at the history of the relationship between the gypsy community and the non-gypsy community, whilst, of course, there is sometimes bad behaviour that comes out of the gypsy community, the vast amount of pain and hatefulness has come from the wider world towards us. Historically, in this country, that has meant the hanging of the gypsy people, the deportation of the gypsy people, the forced assimilation of the gypsy people. Across Europe, that's meant the Third Reich Nazi genocide towards the gypsy people. And in every country that we've kind of passed through on our journey from India to Britain, generally there's been some pretty horrible laws and policies, and that continues to this day. So we are very much kind of a minority, a marginalized minority, but also very kind of a proud and resilient minority that does its best just to carry on living the way that we want to live in extended family networks. For some of us, that means being nomadic, but increasingly it means that we are sedentary as well. And we just want to kind of live the way that we want to live. So we're not a threat to anybody, but we are often threatened by the societies that we live in.
Now, this whole idea of, you know, actually staying on bits of open land around the place, is this something which is you've found over the last few decades has become more difficult to do? Because I know local authorities like ours here in Bristol are supposed to provide transit sites for gypsies and travellers so that it's easy enough to stop off in Bristol for a few days or even for a couple of months on the way somewhere.
Yeah, it is something that has definitely become harder since probably about the 1960s. What you have found has happened is there's been two things happening at the same time, is that there has been a kind of an increasing kind of industrialization of our landscape, which means that gypsies and travelers who would traditionally have maybe worked in farm work or in rural trades, fruit picking, you know, pea picking, potato picking, beet picking, have had to find different ways of making a living. At the same time, that industrialization has meant that more and more places, commons, byways, the kind of places where our ancestors used to stop, have been either built on or developed or actively had rocks put on them or ditches put through them to stop gypsies and travellers stopping there. Now, if you combine that with the second thing which is happening, which is a kind of an increasing intolerance of difference within the British landscape, within the British rural or kind of urban fringe, you see that there's less and less places for people to be. And so what that has caused is the gypsies and travellers that still live that way or want to live that way still have to be somewhere. They cannot simply disappear simply because the council bureaucrat decides to put rocks on a common. And so that's forced people into living in lay-bys, maybe pulling onto car parks, maybe going onto playing fields, the kind of places where there is an increasing amount of kind of tension and conflict. And so there is undeniably a conflict. What we would say as a community is that the resolution of that conflict is not simply to try and legislate people out of existence, it's to make some space for us. And we are quite happy to make space for ourselves, but we're often not allowed to through planning legislation. So the gypsy people still want to be able to access that landscape, despite all of those kind of industrial and legislative changes, that those needs, those desires have not been well met or kind of responded to by people either in government, central government, or in local government.
Well, I know Bristol City Council will say, sorry, Jake, but we've provided a traveller site out at Avonmouth. What's the problem?
Now, I can't speak about that traveller site because I've never been there. But what I can tell you is that most of the transit sites that are provided in this country are often in very marginal areas. The one that's nearest to me, a place called Bridie's Town in Sussex, is not even flat. And anybody who has ever stopped in a caravan will know that you need to have somewhere flat to put the jacks down so that you don't fall out of bed. It's not flat. It's in between a trunk road and a tip. And what you often find with any sites that are built, whether they're permanent or transit, is they're built in the kinds of environmentally marginal areas where you wouldn't put a dog.
Well, I mean, just for people that don't know the Avonmouth site, which is the Bristol City Council's site, it's in between an incinerator, a sewage works, and a motorway.
Yeah, exactly. I could have predicted that without ever really having been there. And you find that about gypsy sites in most places. The only gypsy site I ever was in Hastings, in the town in which I live, was down by the dump. And you don't have to have a kind of a degree in psychology to realize that if you're the only place available for you is at the rubbish tip, the society is actually regarding you as dirt, as a matter out of place and something that shouldn't belong. So most gypsies and travelers don't see themselves that way. They don't see their families that way. They would rather be in places where most other people would want to be. So in a lot of cases, people don't want to be on transit sites. There's one down in Dorset in a place called Piddle Hinton, which sounds very romantic, but it's right next to an MOD firing range and next to kind of an industrial facility. When I was on there about a month ago, the people didn't want to be there. They'd been forced there by the authorities in Dorset, who said you either have to go there or you have to leave the county. Now, I can't think of another ethnic community which is subjected to that kind of treatment, where you are forced to go into an area next to a firing range and next to an industrial facility, or you have to leave the county. I've been making a television series this summer called 60 Days with the Gypsies, and we've come across a number of occasions where gypsy families have been convoyed out of counties. Imagine that happening to a black family or an Asian family that came to a town. It's unthinkable that that would even happen in our society, yet it still happens to gypsies and travellers. Not only does it still happen, but it doesn't even really reach the news that this kind of stuff happens. So we're talking about a form of legitimised prejudice and acceptable racism that isn't really experienced by any other community within our society.
Well, I mean, the councils, Jake, and some of the residents anyway, might say, well, you don't pay any council tax, so why should they give you any land in the first place?
We don't say that to people who are foreign visitors to our shores. I mean, I would dispute that, the premise of that argument entirely anyway, in that most gypsies and travellers nowadays have an address, whether that's a site or a house, where they are resident and pay council tax. But let's say that the premise of that point was true. We don't say that to foreign visitors that come to our shores. When foreign visitors that come to Britain move into an area, let's say Weston-super-Mare, for example, down in your neck of the woods, accommodation is made available for which those people pay something for that accommodation, whether it's a hostel or a hotel room or a travel lodge, people pay their way. And gypsies and travellers are quite prepared to do the same thing. What you often find, though, is that if gypsies and travellers try and go to a caravan site, for example, if they have commercial vehicles or if they have vehicles which look gypsy, i.e. they often have twin axles and they're often bigger than the average touring caravan, they won't be allowed onto them. So you find that people can't pay their way, even if they want to. But there are places in this country now where there's a system of negotiated stopping, where the local authorities are beginning to work with gypsy and traveller families and saying that there's a piece of land here, this is available for you. You know, we'll provide skips, we'll provide toilets, we'll provide, you know, freedom from harassment and eviction if you pay your way. And when that works, it works really, really well. So there's no reason why every local authority in this country couldn't adopt a similar approach.
When we talk about gypsies and travellers, particularly the word travellers, can mean quite a lot of different things, can't it? There are traditional travellers and these sort of new age travellers. Can you just sort of break down for us a little bit the different types of people that live on the road?
Sure. So there is a whole kind of spectrum of people that fall under the term traveller. The community that I'm from, which is probably the biggest one of all, is the Romani gypsy community. Our culture comes all the way from India. Part of that means being nomadic, but actually in large parts of Europe, the Romani community is actually living in housing, particularly in places like Eastern Europe. The next kind of ethnic group, which you would consider in terms of size, is the Irish traveller community, which whilst it may look the same from the outside, actually comes from completely the opposite point on the compass. It comes not from the east, but from the west. It comes from Ireland. There's probably about 30 to 60,000 Irish travellers in Britain. You also have another ethnic group, which is Scottish travellers. There aren't that many in England. They're largely found in Scotland, but in parts of the north of England as well. And then, of course, a big community that you do have in the southwest of England is the new traveller community. These are people who generally come out of what we call the Gorgia or non-Gypsy community that for often very positive reasons, have decided that they would prefer living in vehicles. Often that's motivated by kind of an alternative lifestyle choice, working on the festival scene. But often it's also motivated by the fact that there's a kind of housing crisis in this country where it's cheaper often to live in a vehicle and often easier to live in a vehicle. And for some people, of course, it is the last stop before street homelessness. So there are also people increasingly during this pandemic that are living in vans, who, you know, kind of are living in often on the outskirts of cities, places like Bristol or Brighton, where they've created their own culture. A lot of them wouldn't even call themselves new travellers, but they're people who might refer to themselves as van dwellers. So that's really the kind of the spectrum that there is of anybody who would fall under the term traveller in Britain.
Yeah, and roughly how many people do you think are living? I think, I mean, it must be slowly increasing at the moment since we've had so many people suffering with the evictions of Universal Credit, the increase in particularly in private rented accommodation rates and things like that. So roughly how many people do you think are living as gypsies or travellers in Britain?
It's really, really difficult to say. I mean, what we do know, and these are kind of rough, if not conservative estimates, is there are probably about 300,000 gypsies and travellers in Britain. There are also probably about another 300,000 Roma migrants. So these are Romani people that have moved from Eastern Europe to Britain. They generally live in kind of urban areas and flats, houses on multiple occupation and things like that. In terms of the amount of people that have gone over to living in vehicles during the pandemic, I haven't seen any figures on that. But you're right, it is increasing because we've kind of evictions because of things like universal credit. It is often the last kind of safety net for those people who maybe have a little bit of money to buy themselves a van before they hit street homelessness. And those numbers obviously have increased. Anecdotally, we know that. I don't think there's been any studies to even try and find a figure for it.
Well, this is part of the problem, isn't it? It's a part of our community that often gets forgotten when looking at, you know, actual numbers and totting up how to deal with social problems. Is often travellers and gypsies are just completely off the radar somewhere. But anyway, they're not off the radar at the Home Office because we've got this police crime sentencing and courts bill coming down the tubes by Priti Patel, which is threatening to criminalise travellers who park up at the side of the road. The landowner can feel threatened, supposedly, and then phone the police, and they could potentially be arrested along with their children, the vehicles impounded, and maybe even doing quite lengthy jail sentences potentially. So can you just take us through this bill and what you think's behind it, and then maybe, you know, what can be done?
Well, if we have a look at the part four of that bill, the police crime sentencing and courts bill, which is otherwise known as the police bill or the policing bill, part four of that specifically targets gypsy and traveller communities in trying to wipe out a nomadic way of life. And it does that in a number of ways. It brings in a new offence of criminal trespass to anybody who is residing on land where they don't have permission. Now, that could be anywhere. That could be a lay-by, that could be a common, it could be a byway, it could be a playing field, it could be a car park, it could be any of those things where people are forced to stop because there is a shortage of stopping places. And anybody found guilty of that can be given a $2,500 fine. They can have their vehicle seized and they can also be imprisoned. So for the first time in British history, trespass won't be seen as a kind of a civil offence, a dispute between two parties, but a criminal one where our police will be effectively kind of nationalised bailiffs who will be there to drive the community on or persecute them, imprison them, fine them and take their homes off them. It's a massive departure from the way policy has been in the past, which is horrific. And it's why we started the Drive to Survive campaign to resist it, to warn the gypsy and traveller community before it's too late, that they have to stand together with their friends and colleagues and human rights organisations, environmental organisations, and on the left side of politics, that if we don't stand together to resist this, then Britain will have embarked on a series of policies, on a policy towards our community, which was last tried by the Nazis. And I don't use that parallel lightly. When we look at history in Germany, we know that the horrific stuff that happened, where nearly 1.5 million Romani people were killed in the gas chambers, the only other ethnic group alongside the Jews that was subject to the Final Solution, that those policies started with banning nomadism. They started with trying to settle people forcibly by shooting their horses and burning their wagons. Now, fines and imprisonment and the seizure of homes is not quite as extreme as that, but it's still pretty extreme. And it does have a parallel with a very dark period of European history.
What do you think's motivating it, Joe?
I think it's red meat for the Nazi Party. I think there are, thankfully, now very few communities which you can be openly hostile to. Even the Nazi Party, the Conservative Party, knows that it cannot be openly hostile towards people who are black or Asian. It knows it cannot be openly homophobic. So there are very few legitimate targets left for open hostility based upon somebody's identity. That doesn't mean to say that homophobia doesn't exist or racism towards black and Asian communities doesn't exist, because of course it still does. But it's often hidden, and it's often hidden behind smoke screens and fig leaves. And the fact that there is a Asian Home Secretary is a very clever, if somewhat transparent, ploy, that if you have a woman of kind of Indian heritage via Uganda bringing this stuff in, that this stuff couldn't possibly be racist. But it is racist. If kind of a key component of a recognized ethnic group's identity is a nomadic history and culture, and you then ban that culture, to us it is the equivalent of saying Muslims can no longer go to mosque, or Jewish people can no longer go to the synagogue. And we take it seriously. We feel very threatened by it. But equally, and maybe this will be our Black Lives Matter or Martin Luther King moment, we know that we cannot follow this law, that we will have to break it at every opportunity, because we are morally compelled to break bad laws. And that is a tradition which is part of the British tradition as well, from the suffragettes to, you know, internationally to people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And we will be breaking it, actively breaking it at every opportunity, because we have no doubt that it will probably be passed into legislation at some point over the autumn, despite our best efforts. And that's really when the hardware probably begins.
The police actually called for this. Have they been having a lot of trouble with gypsies and travellers? Obviously, the Home Office is usually driven by requests from the police chief constables.
Interestingly, they haven't. Interestingly, in consultations that the Conservative Party did and the government did on this piece of legislation, the National Police Chiefs Council were unified. They were speaking in unity with the gypsy community and saying that these powers aren't needed. There are already extremely strong powers of eviction that the police have, things like Section 61 of the Criminal Justice Act, which means that they can move any encampment on within hours if there is any evidence of antisocial behaviour or criminality. So those laws already exist. They've existed since 1994. So the police actually, on this occasion, are actually more liberal and less in demand of these powers than the Conservative Party, which is why most of us have come to the conclusion that this is just performative prejudice, which is producing red meat for the Conservative Party.
Is there likely to be any kind of pushback in Parliament, in the Lords or the Commons at all against this act? And what stage is this bill at?
There has been pushback in Parliament, but we have to remember the English people in particular, in their wisdom, voted in large numbers, still a minority, but in large numbers for our very outdated electoral system for the Conservative Party. They have an 80-seat majority, so have voted it through its last reading on July the 3rd. It will be going to the Lords on the 15th of September. And there will be a pushback in the Lords as well. There isn't a government majority in there. But the convention is you know, that anything that is a primary piece of legislation that was promised in an election manifesto eventually will also be given the nod by the Lords. So we're under no illusion whatsoever that this will probably become law within the next couple of months.
Something pretty incredible is going on here, Jake, isn't it? I mean, so far as I know, ever since the dawn of time, it's been normal and natural, not just for gypsies or Romanies, but for anybody to stop and camp on the side of the road if they're on their way across the country. And this is possibly, I think, probably the first time ever that this is going to be seen as something which is a crime.
That's right. I mean, the point that I always make whenever I'm speaking to people is that we're not asking for any right that is specific to our race or identity. We are asking for this to be a human right that's enshrined in law. You're absolutely right. People have long travelled in these islands, and they have long stopped at the side of the road, and long may they continue to do so. It's a human right that we're fighting for. And this law, whilst it's definitely been targeted towards the Gypsy and Traveller community, will affect far more people than that. It will affect people who are living in vehicles as a response to personal homelessness. It will affect people who want to get out and enjoy the landscape in a way which is above and beyond and deeper than just that of being a recreational visitor and a tourist. It will affect anybody that kind of wants to access the landscape beyond a day trip down a footpath. And that means it should be resisted strongly by anybody that hears about it. Because, you know, people can only kill the natural world with impunity if people are not familiar and connected to it. And in a time of kind of climate change and extinction rebellion, where people need to be intimately acquainted with the natural world in order to love it and defend it, any piece of legislation which attempts to remove and sever that connection with the natural world, with the landscape, is one that should be resisted.
Yes, the incredible thing is it's also linked in with, in this bill with stopping the right to protest, or at least severely limiting it. But anyway, look, your group, Drive to Survive, can you let us know how people can get hold of that, to follow it? And what's the best way to keep track of what's going on, Jake?
Sure. So the best way is for our website, which is drivetosurvive.org.uk. But I'm also going to send you a GoFundMe thing that we're doing, which is to try and raise money to help us in our campaign. All of us are volunteers. We're not a charity. We've been up and running for about 2 months, and we really, really need all the help that we can get. Any fivers or tenners that people have got spare, you just need to go to gofundme.com/F/drive, then the number 2 survive. And we're raising money there. We've had some really good donations, but in order to keep going, we need more donations.
And the website is drive2survive.org.uk.
That's it. drive2survive.org.uk. Everything that we're doing, we're trying to get as many people as possible down to the Conservative Party conference from the 2nd of October onwards to make some noise, to let Priti Patel and Boris Johnson know that we have no intention of going quietly into the history books. In fact, we have no intention of going into the history books at all. We will be fighting this tooth and nail. When it becomes law, we have lawyers and barristers on standby to take this into the courts to show that this is a fundamental breach of human rights legislation that will be resisted at every turn until it is repealed.
Jake Bowers, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So that's Jake Bowers there speaking to me earlier this week. He seems to think he's the only Gypsy Roma broadcast journalist in Britain, and he probably is. 300,000 of them, amazing. And how absolutely incredible that the government are thinking about criminalising this for the first time ever. never been criminal to pull over on the side onto a piece of land before, and now it is. It used to be a civil offence, and no longer. Anyway, our other big feature this week is an interview I did earlier this week with a funeral director in Milton Keynes, and he's very, very worried about this week's ONS figures reported by Sarah Napton in the Daily Telegraph, the sixth week in succession where we've had above average deaths. The question is, why is this happening? Is it the destruction of the NHS or is it the vaccine? Can we trust anyone to tell us the truth about why so many extra people are dying right now? So let's have a listen now to his name is John O'Looney, and he's a funeral director from Milton Keynes.
My name's John O'Looney. I'm a Milton Keynes-based funeral director. I'm 53 years old, and I've been in the business approximately 15 years now. I did nearly 10 for one of the main funeral providers, which is Co-op Funeral Care. And the last 4 or 5 years, I've been on my own, running my own funeral home.
You've been quite worried about the way that you've experienced what's been going on over the last 18 months with this COVID. So can you just take us through what concerns that you've had?
Okay. So in 2019, in November, end of November, I had a family come to me who'd lost a loved one in the neighbouring borough of Northamptonshire, and their loved one was at Northampton General Hospital. It's a little bit out of area, but I do go there occasionally. I'm originally from Northampton. So I said to them, look, don't worry. I'll go to the hospital, drop what I'm doing, go over there, pick your loved one up, bring them back here, and you can see them here. So I went to Northampton, and liaised with the staff in the mortuary, and kind of said to them, you know, while I was there, the family tell me you wouldn't allow them to visit. Why is that? And they opened the viewing room that is attached to the mortuary, and there was an inflatable tent type pandemic blow up mortuary thing. I'd never seen one before, to be honest. So I kind of said, what's that? And they kind of said, well, it's a pandemic tent. And I said, well, why is that here? And they said, well, there's something horrible coming. And that was where the conversation really ended. So I went home and told my, you know, friends and relatives, you know, you might want to think about stocking up or whatever. I've been told something horrible's coming and, you know, perhaps we should think about preparing. So that was done. Just after Christmas, the news broke about, you know, this virus coming out of China, and I was totally consumed. I totally believed it, you know, and that kind of carried on from there. And then a short while after, I had a guy ring the funeral home who announced himself as a government sponsored pandemic guy. Now, this guy said to me, you know, due to the COVID crisis, we're going to be calling you every week. We've got a number of questions we're going to ask you. And they will be comprised of the following. So what is your capacity as a funeral home? So I told him, how many have you picked up this week and how many are COVID and where from? So I would give him this information every Monday when he called up. And it was a number of different people, but one primarily called John, same name as me. So we got quite friendly over the months and I would tell him each week. But it wasn't too long before I found that I felt they were steering me a bit. And by that, I mean, I would say, for example, I'd picked up someone who died from cancer, and they would then say, well, where was that? And wasn't there cancer in that hospice, or wasn't there cancer in that care home? Or I picked up a gentleman in his 90s that had passed away just as a result of old age. And they would say, yeah, but wasn't there COVID in that care home? And I would kind of say, well, no, because I've not seen any tests. I wasn't told it was COVID. No, it wasn't a COVID death. And he's saying, well, I'm sorry, but there was COVID in that care home. There was COVID in that hospital.
John, well, look, where was this guy calling from?
I really don't know. He just announced himself as a government COVID guy. And it was my understanding he was ringing all of the funeral directors. And you have to remember, you know, we do get the odd crank call and people selling things. But this guy really sounded legit, you know. He said he was a government-sponsored pandemic guy and he was coordinating with all the funeral homes. And I did speak to other funeral homes and he was indeed calling them, or somebody was, you know. And this particular guy, it was his job to call all the local funeral homes. Now, I got to know him over the months.
When did he start calling you?
It was early 2020 until about, I would say, October, November of last year. And then I got an email telling me there wouldn't be any need anymore for him to call me. You know, why that is, I don't know, because they still seem like it's raging everywhere. But I would suggest it's because they were inflating numbers deliberately to encourage everyone to have a life-saving injection. And that has been accomplished now, hasn't it? So there's no need for him to call me anymore. And that's what's happened. They don't call anymore.
Okay, so take it from there, when this, after this guy started calling you.
So this guy started calling me, and he was just steering me towards inflating numbers, you know, consistently, week after week. I mean, even one guy that was run over was down as a COVID death. So I was getting more and more families coming to me, very angry and very upset that their terminal cancer patient, loved one, was labelled as a COVID death. And the way that was working is, during the terminal cancer kind of end of life, as it progresses, they end up going into hospital for palliative care, or a care home, or a hospice for palliative care. And that basically means they starve these poor souls to death. And whilst they have a morphine driver in their arm, and the dose goes up increasingly, I would imagine, with the pain and suffering, bless them. So they were spam testing these people with PCR tests, the same tests that have been discredited by the guy who invented them. You know, there are so many cycles you should run these PCR tests, and they're doing it in such a way that the guy who designed them said they'd find, you know, COVID in a trainer if they did it using the methods
they've
done.
Well, that's right. This is Carrie Mullis. He's on the reference train, and he died just before the whole outbreak.
Exactly that. So. You know, here's a fundamentally flawed testing method, and then they're relabeling these people as COVID. And I had people coming into me desperately upset, not because they'd lost a loved one, but because they were terrified I then wouldn't wash and dress their loved one. They wouldn't be able to spend time with them because nobody else would dress or wash a COVID patient. And I would hasten to add, very early in the process in 2020, February time, I had a family come and see me who lost a little girl of six. And, you know, they wanted to see their little girl. It was cancer. It wasn't COVID. In fact, I haven't heard of a single child dying anywhere from COVID. So I find it very bizarre that they're now trying to target children for jabs. But this family wanted to see their child. And I kind of said, yeah, no problem. I embalmed her and washed and dressed her and presented them, this young girl, to her. Lovely family, West Indian family, beautiful people. And they thanked me. And I kind of thought, well, do you know what? If I could do that for them, I could do it for everyone. So I washed and dressed everyone, COVID or not. And I kind of did it in the first few months waiting to fall over. But it never happened, you know, and it's a miracle I'm alive, clearly.
Can I just ask you how old you are and your staff? Because this is quite a major factor, isn't it? And
I'm 53. I've got a little bit of blood pressure, I suppose, for a 53-year-old. I've got asthma. Being an ex-smoker. Other than that, I'm fairly healthy, you know, no underlying conditions but I'm a prime candidate. I've had letters. I've been spammed letters and phone calls saying how terribly at risk I am, and, you know, I'm going to get seriously ill and die. Meanwhile, I've continued to wash and dress all of these COVID patients. And you've got to remember, a lot of these people, they're coming into me bereft because they lost their mum or dad in a hospital. They're supposed to be caring for them, and they were forced to wear a hazmat suit standing next to the bed, or they weren't allowed in at all. They lost their mum over a Zoom call, you know, which I find absolutely, you know, when you've got people that have taken a Hippocratic oath, clearly not abiding and adhering to it, it's unbelievable. So I was desperately trying to give these people the time and the care that they hadn't been given in the hospitals, you know.
What about where people were dying? Have you seen that change over the last 18 months? Because I understand most people, basically, they will be dying in hospices and hospitals rather than care homes, won't they, normally?
So we're talking about two waves. The first wave was March and April and was exclusively in care homes and lasted between 2 and 3 weeks. Now, as a society, we're very, very good at getting people to pass away in hospitals. You know, that the system works that way. And I would suggest if I had 10 collections of deceased, 8 of them would be from hospital, 1 from a care home, and 1 from a residential address where they'd gone home to die, you know. I had 3 weeks in March and April of 2020 exclusively going to care homes. And this was unheard of. You know, I've worked for the big funeral providers where they've got 60% market share. I've never attended a care home 5 nights on the trot. You know, I'm now doing a lot less funerals a year for myself as a private, small individual funeral home. And I went to a care home every night for nearly 3 weeks on the trot. That's unheard of, and it's unnatural. It's not normal. And I've since kind of found out that this was at the same time that the procurement of midazolam, which is a sedative they use primarily in care homes, was increased by 1,000%. Now, you can read into that what you will. But that's fact, and that's been collated by a number of people and is consistently totally ignored. I think Matt Hancock stood up in Parliament and said to provide them with a good death, was my understanding.
So what was going on there, do you think? What we've seen is that quite a lot of people have said that they believe that their loved ones were actually encouraged to die in care.
Yeah,
now, is that feasible?
Yes, that has happened. And I spoke to a number of individuals. One lady I spoke to, I'll give you a scenario based on what one lady told me, her complete story. Mum had a stroke and was in hospital 6 weeks, was recovering well, but didn't have full mobility. However, she was fully coherent, laughing and joking. She was transferred to a local care home. And she spoke to her mum in the morning and was laughing and joking on the phone. She rang back later to speak to her mum that day, and a staff member answered and said, she's gone. So the girl said, oh, okay, where have you transferred her to? What do you mean she's gone? I said, no, she's gone. She's dead. And that is a story I've heard more and more and more and more and more of. So I would suggest that I suspect people have been funneled from hospitals into care homes and they've been euthanized using midazolam, and the procurement rates would support that suspicion, to be honest. I've been in touch with a guy who's devoted himself via FOIs, Freedom of Information, to collate that data, and it's utterly damning. It's utterly damning. You know, and they've talked about midazolam being procured to facilitate intubating patients, to sedate them so they could put them on a ventilator, you know. I never saw one ventilator in any care homes ever. So it clearly wasn't in the care home environment, yet that's where the death rate was unnaturally high for a very short, concentrated period of 3 weeks. I mean, my mortuary book will tell the story, and I suspect other funeral homes will have the same story, and we'll look back on that and find it extremely unusual. I've never known anything like it.
Yes, pretty shocking. So not only was it potential that people were being transferred into care homes and catching COVID, but also that there was some sort of program that we weren't being told about. Certainly the loved ones weren't being told about in order to. I mean, I suppose there is also the fact that a lot of these elderly people are owed enormous amounts in pension and may go on for decades.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. I can tell you these people weren't COVID deaths. They weren't COVID deaths. I washed and dressed them all personally. I couldn't even get masks because everybody was panicked buying them, you know, but they were shipping these people into care homes and refusing to allow anyone of their family in to see them. How can I tell them they can't see their mum and dad? You know, I can't bring myself to do it. So I washed and dressed them all. They weren't COVID. I never saw one test even done. No, you know, nobody ever talked to me about doing a COVID test on any of the deceased that I collected, yet they were all down as COVID. I just failed to see that because there was never any doctor in attendance, the same as there isn't now. You lose a loved one and you make a phone call, they'll authorise you over the phone to contact a funeral director. Yeah, in fact, I've got a letter from Thames Valley Police. Where is it? I'm just looking. And it was dated March of last year, and it informs me that police or the doctors won't be attending, so they've asked me to declare death and to raise any suspicions should I feel the need to do so. And I kind of replied telling this particular officer, I'm not paid to do their job. You know, I'm not prepared. I'm not certainly not qualified to certify death. And you know, if you picture the scene, if I go to a residential address and I see some blood on the pillow, am I going to start telling the family I've got to call the police because I'm not happy? It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Do you know, COVID seems to have been a great, great excuse for a lot of people just to totally stop caring.
Well, actually, maybe those people didn't care. I mean, it's one of the interesting things about this is that, you know, we like to think that people take on a profession because they're a caring person in medicine, particularly doctors. But actually, of course, there's another reason. And that is maybe for the money, because it's a very well paid profession. It's a very prestigious profession. So it might not necessarily just be because their heart is in it. It might be, you know, are there all sorts of potential motives why somebody might take on a specific profession. Anyway, look, so this, you're talking now, I think, about April, May, aren't you, 2020?
Yes, yes. So after that short period, that was from, in fact, I can look on my wall planner, to the second week in April. So from April, May, second week in May. So from May 2020, the second half of May, until October, November, December, it was absolutely normal. There was no increased death rate anywhere. And I would hasten to add, I'm in a number of WhatsApp groups with other funeral directors locally who all were saying the same thing. And I was beginning to smell a rat by then. And I kind of, to the point where I said to my wife, they well advertised that locally, oh, we're going to bring this life-saving injection out on January the 6th locally at Milton Keynes. And I said to my wife and a number of others, I wonder if the death rate will soar when they begin vaccinating. And we broke up for Christmas. I had one chap who lost his wife on Christmas Day, bless him, and I went out and looked after him. And it's particularly sad. I actually went back in the evening and took him some Christmas dinner, bless him, because he was on his own. And I'll never forget him. He's a lovely man, bless him. But I broke up for Christmas, come back after Christmas, and I think it was January the 2nd we came back. They began vaccinating on the 6th, and the death rate went through the roof. I've never known anything like it in 15 years. I would estimate it went up 250%, maybe. Do you know, I had the hospital ringing me up, begging me to pick people up, people crying down the phone. It was unbelievable. And it was at the exact moment they began vaccinating. And that lasted a lot longer than the first wave. That lasted until, and I'm looking at my wall planner now, the second week in April. And then it petered off as though it never had happened. And then from May, June, July, August until now, so 4 months, we had virtually nothing. And it was unnaturally quiet. I've never known it so quiet. So, and now the last 10 days, the phone started ringing again. We've had a couple of COVID cases in. And I sense that there's another extreme death rate about to emerge. Interestingly, just at the time they're announcing boosters, just to reassure everyone.
So what do you think was going on there?
I think, to be honest with you, there's something in these injections that's damaging and hurting people. And I kind of wrote an open letter, a couple of posts. I did a post on YouTube. I love YouTube. You know, I like looking at YouTube, and I kept seeing all these COVID hysteria posts on YouTube, and commented on one, basically to say, look, as a funeral director, this is not what I'm seeing. And then I had the inevitable guy, you know, say, you're not a funeral director, you're an activist, you know. So you've got two choices then, haven't you? You either shut up and walk away, or you say, well, actually, I'm a funeral director and this is me. So I kind of identified myself with an open letter. And then, of course, I was surprised at the response. It was really positive. I've had thousands and thousands of people contact me, doctors, nurses of 20 and 30 years, loads and loads of victims, people that have lost loved ones shortly after a jab. I mean, I had a family, and a Tamil family. They were lovely, bless them. And their father went down to get a jab. He was died after an hour. I had another one who was paralyzed shortly after taking the first jab. So he was then considered vulnerable. So they gave him the second jab, and then he died a day later. I had another one, his mother went blind immediately after it. So, you know, these are, I'm getting lots and lots of these one in a millions, they call it, don't they? I must be the unluckiest funeral director in the country, because I've, you know, getting an unnaturally level of adverse effects and deaths not long after vaccines.
Well, isn't it interesting? Because most people, you know, if they've lost a loved one, they haven't got the ability to see patterns developing like you have.
No. Yeah, exactly that. I mean, and you got to remember, if I get someone come to see me who's lost a loved one and they're told by the hospital it's COVID, they're going to believe it's COVID. You know, the fact that they had their two jabs and the last one 6 weeks ago doesn't enter their mind. And I'm finding now that I'm getting a number of youngsters, and by youngsters, I'm 53. So youngsters, I'm talking anything younger, really. But 40-year-olds, 35-year-olds that are dying suddenly from blood clot-related heart attack. You know, and I'm finding nobody seems to be taking a great deal of interest in that either. You know, I'm kind of noticing a pattern, and I'm making a point of asking people as well, you know, did mum or dad have a jab? And I'm not keeping any notes, but I'm noting kind of what's happening, and I'm seeing a consistent pattern. I suppose ultimately I'm in a unique position to see things here that the average Joe Bloggs, a plumber, electrician or a baker, someone works in Morrison's, wouldn't see, you know. And it's really, really, really worrying. And early on in the game, I had the BBC contacted me out of the blue. And they asked me as a funeral director, could they come and do an interview? And this was March 2020 time. So I had a couple from the BBC come out. It was a cameraman and a lady. And they sat down for half an hour and they briefed me, told me everything they were going to ask me and made sure that I was going to give them the answers they wanted, briefed me fully. That was the first interview I'd ever done, you know, so I didn't think anything of it. But interestingly, every interview I've done since, nobody has ever felt the need to do that. They just ask me a question and I tell them the answer, you know, but they briefed me for about half an hour, made me put PPE on. And I remember at the time being quite reluctant to put a mask on and stuff because I didn't really have much. And this was at the time, you know, I was totally, I believed COVID the same as the vast majority of other people. So I was, you know, I kind of didn't want to waste it on a photo shoot, you know, especially when I've got to wash and dress these people. So they got their interview and I kind of, on reflection, I kicked myself because all I did was promote their hysteria narrative, you know. And it's funny because since coming out and being honest and open, I've spoke to people from New Zealand, Hong Kong, Singapore, all over the world, thousands of them now over the last couple of months. And the BBC, the silence is deafening. You know, why would they not want to come and find out why I feel the way I do and reassure me? You know, don't they want to find out my concerns? You know, why do I feel like this in the middle of a deadly pandemic? As a funeral director, wouldn't you want to reassure the public? Nobody wants to talk to me now. It's funny that.
Yeah. So what do you think is, I mean, there seems to be a big mismatch between what you're seeing and what you're saying and what we're getting on the TV and the newspapers.
Yeah, there definitely is. I mean, there's no huge death rate at the moment. It has picked up a lot, but it was extremely quiet. And I'm not sure if maybe the people that would have died over the last 3 or 4 months just died at the beginning of the year as a result of a vaccine. It just took them past the threshold maybe. But only today I had a lady in and I was talking to this particular lady who was a double jab recipient. And she was telling me since she's had the second jab, her health has plummeted. And I said to her, well, have you thought about, you know, maybe using the yellow card system? What yellow card system? She wasn't even aware there was one, you know? So I would suggest there are lots of people out there that perhaps don't feel very well or unwell after having a second jab. I spoke to another lady who can't stop bleeding constantly, you know, since having the first jab, that was. Now, if these people are out there and they're going through these things, you know, and you don't have to die to report it. You should be reporting any adverse effects. You know, the government have got a yellow card system there. Please use it because I kind of suspect the ones that are on there, and I think it's 5,000 or 6,000 officially recognized vaccine deaths at the moment as a result of the vaccine on the yellow card system. You know, they need to add their adverse effects to it.
Don't you wonder, though, that because you've put your head above the parapet, you're getting actually a massive sort of concentration of people who are skeptical about the vaccine coming to you. So, again, you're not actually getting a full picture.
To be honest with you, I've had no one who comes through these doors mention what I've said. Nothing. They come through these doors because they want me to look after mum or dad. And I was concerned when I first sent the open letter out. But, you know, I've got two choices as a decent human, haven't I? I can be in the position I'm in and just do these funerals and not say anything to anyone and make myself complicit. Or I can actually speak out. Now, if I speak out, I'm damned and condemned. If I don't speak out, what would I be? I'd be damned and condemned. I'd be out of order. If you see a disturbing pattern, you should be able to talk about it. I mean, people have talked about me being brave. Isn't that statement in itself really telling where we've come to a point in this country, in an alleged democracy, where in order to say about concerns that you have, you're considered brave? Isn't that really chilling?
Look, the other thing I've got to ask you, because we do stuff about Freemasonry on this show, is, you know, the funeral industry, if we can call it that,
yeah. I mean,
it shouldn't be like a kind of production line on a factory, obviously, but that Freemasonry is quite big in there. Can I ask you about, you know, your view of Freemasonry? Are you a Freemason?
I, should we say, I dipped my toe in the water and I felt that it wasn't for me. That's as much as I'd be prepared to say, to be honest with you.
I mean, I'm going to press you on what it was about Freemasonry that made you think that maybe this wasn't going to be for you.
I think one of the things I've realized as I've got older is probably one of my biggest regrets is tolerating people I didn't really want to spend time with, you know, as a younger man. And I think in order to keep the company of people, you have to have something in common and feel as though it's really for you. You know, I'm a father, I'm running a successful business, and you have to have time spare and then want to spend that time. Whilst many of the men that I met were came across as really nice guys, I just felt it wasn't for me, you know, and so I kind of made my excuses and I left. And that is about as much as I could possibly say.
Okay, well, thanks ever so much. And how, what do you think is the best way to, for people, for listeners to follow what's going on? Because we're clearly not being told the truth. What we're being told is a half-truth, really, by the mass media.
To be honest with you, I don't think they're being very honest at all. One of the main concerns for me as a funeral director is centres around informed consent and adhering to things like the Nuremberg Code. They're not doing that. If you take when you go for a jab, you will have an insert with that jab, and it will give you all the information about that jab and the contents of it and the possible side effects, et cetera, et cetera. The jab inserts are all totally blank, so you're not being given informed consent. And that is the most concerning thing for me. And I can tell you as a funeral director, I've spoke to many doctors, many nurses of 20 and 30 years, dozens and dozens of victims, professionals. I've spoken to a professor and a virologist who got in touch with me and reached out to me. There are loads of people far more qualified and far more respected than me who are voicing very serious concerns. I personally would put myself out on a limb, and I think it's a very sinister thing, and it revolves around money, control, and possibly a cull, is my feeling, because I'm really worried for the future with jab recipients, and also that the two-tier social system we seem to be building around the have and the have-nots as regard the vaccine. And yet today I'm hearing that people now, they're saying that the vaccines won't be as effective after 6 months. So now, you know, they're constantly moving the goalposts. You're going to have boosters now for the foreseeable future. To me, that's ridiculous. No, I'm in touch with a lot of funeral directors. I've not heard of one child dying at all, not anywhere. And if I had, it would be news in this industry, especially locally. So why are we targeting children? Do you know, it's not been tested. It's not safe. It's not licensed anywhere. And I can tell you, I'm having people come through me that have died as a result of having it. So why are we not having open dialogue about this?
That's a good question. I mean, I as a journalist have seen, you know, spotted, I suppose, right from the start, a very, very great deal of bias. Also having my station manager, Patrick Hart, basically boot me off the airways. I had a 12-year run of a weekly politics program in Bristol, and he decided in his wisdom that the public in the city here shouldn't hear me on FM anymore. So we've been running this show as a podcast ever since. Also today, just to pick up on, you know, in a way encapsulating much of what you've been saying in the Daily Telegraph, we have a headline, a story written by Sarah Napton, saying deaths in Britain are above average for the sixth week running. Experts are warning that a year of healthcare disrupted by the COVID crisis may now be beginning to show. Charities have consistently warned, apparently, that a health time bomb is looming because COVID could not access appointments or operations at the height of the pandemic. Deaths in Britain are above average for the sixth week running, with experts warning a year of disruptive healthcare may be starting to show in the figures. Well, that's an interesting fact, the statistics at the back of it. And actually, you know, you can see the ONS page as well. You know, the ONS are providing the figures for these stories. So they're saying that this is a well, they're calling it a time bomb, that it's been chugging along for months, and now finally chickens are coming home to roost. But there definitely may be more to it than that, mightn't there?
I mean, I'm finding that's definitely a pattern I could concur with. For example, I've had more and more families who've come into me that have lost someone to cancer, and they've not presented until stage four because there is no healthcare. There's no healthcare, so it's not being discovered. I've had families come into me increasingly angry. I mean, I kind of said earlier in a post, I wish I had a pound for every time a really angry family had come in to see me who felt hurt and let down by the health system, because I'd have a big bag full of pounds. It's unusual now to hear someone come in and say, do you know what, that they did everything they could and more. I'm not hearing that anymore, and I used to. And I would suggest, you know, there's a large number of doctors and nurses that have quietly been kicked out. One springs to mind, Dr. Sam White, and you'll know all about him, no doubt. They know what's going on, and I've been told by more than one doctor that the doctors don't run the hospitals anymore. They're under government guidelines, and the government run the hospitals.
Well, that's right. Financial people and insurance people seem to run them. Anyway, look, John, for anybody who's thinking about having a vaccine, obviously their main thing is going to be speaking to doctors. Actually, it's very easy to get a vaccine nowadays without speaking to a doctor, just chatting to a nurse. In fact, people who aren't even trained nurses have been doing injections of these vaccines, which is
Morrison's car park. Yeah.
Well, it seems doubly dangerous, really, since it's not actually been properly tested. So what would you say to people who are rather concerned about, particularly about elderly loved ones that are in care homes, hospital, etc.? What should we be doing?
I'd be honest with you, if I had a loved one that was in a care home and I could possibly have them at home, I would have them at home. That's my kind of gut feeling. Obviously, I can only go on how I personally feel. I would say definitely educate yourself, give yourself all of the information that you possibly can. And you're not going to find that on Google. You're not going to find that at your doctors. You've got to look that little bit deeper. I would hasten to add, I'm happy to have a chat with anyone who wants to call me, and they can find me at the funeral home by accessing the number via my address, web address, which is www.mkffs.co.uk. And I'd be happy to answer any questions or kind of point them in the direction of getting alternative kind of info, and, you know, seeing best case scenario, worst case scenario, and just, you know, being able to get informed consent they're being denied at the injection centres.
So you're based in Milton Keynes.
I'm indeed.
Just generally though, I mean, if you look at what's been happening over the next few weeks, you've seen interesting patterns developing. What do you think we're in store for?
My personal opinion is we're going to see a really increased death rate very shortly. It will be primarily in recipients, though I doubt that will be acknowledged, openly acknowledged. I think they'll blame a newly named variant, and they'll blame people that won't take the poison. And then they'll act accordingly with some kind of draconian laws like we're seeing in France and Australia. That's my gut feeling. Already I've noticed the death rate has picked up a little bit. It seems to be a mixed bag. We're getting the odd COVID case, but also a fair amount of sudden death in younger people as well. Again, you can read into that what you will. But that's my feeling.
Yeah, you will be called, I'm sure, if you were to be up on the BBC tonight on Newsnight, they'll be calling you an anti-vaxxer, John.
To be honest with you, I think if you are in my position and you've seen people that have died, and it's obviously as a direct result or shortly after a vaccine, you're not really going to want to take it, in fairness, are you? If I've sit and listened to a Milton Keynes mother a couple of weeks ago, softly Irish spoken lady, she had a child with special needs who was given a vaccine, and that child is now in a vegetative state, and the local health authority have dropped her like a hot coal, you know. So, and I spoke to this woman, I heard her crying down the phone. She's a Milton Keynes woman as well, and my heart goes out to her. And if she's listening, I just want to say how sorry I am. And if there was anything I could do, I would. There isn't. And all I can do is just try and tell people and try and raise awareness and the hope that my legacy is actually saving a life.
Well, that's one of the things we try and do as well, John. And we've been doing it ever since without the help, obviously, of Bristol Community Radio, which is where I was, or much of the other media. I mean, the other aspect to all of this is we've got, you know, Yeah. What about, you know, because this is the big accusation which is made, anti-vaxxer, anti-vaxxer. Have you ever had a vaccine yourself?
Many, many years ago, I had a flu vaccine. I'm going back about 15 years. And I'll be honest, I've never been so ill. So I've declined every flu vaccine in that sense. And I've never been ill since, you know. And again, I would remind you that I've washed and dressed probably 80 COVID, alleged COVID victims. And I've had to get these poor people out of body bags and clean them up and dry them down and wash them and dress them in clothes and stuff because nobody else would. So I'm pretty sure if it was the deadly plague it's being made out to be, I certainly wouldn't be talking to you now.
And if people are approaching funeral directors asking for care for their loved one, what do you think are the key questions to ask to assess whether this is going to be the right funeral director for you?
Well, first of all, I kind of work on the template of treating people how you want to be treated. So first of all, ask them what the total cost is. If they're reluctant to tell you over the phone, we always put the prices on the website because you've got to remember people that come to see me are in a very poor state emotionally. They're not right. You know, they've undergone a traumatic experience and the loss of a loved one. So they're very vulnerable people. So we as an industry owe it to those people to protect them by they should legislate for the price to be on the website, complete price, and everybody should be doing that, and they don't. So get a price over the phone before you go in and they try and get you crying around the table. Ask if a coffin is included. Ask if coffin bearers are included. And the best bet is for you to ask your people, anyone who wants to know advice, please ring me up. Because I'll get yourself a pen and paper, ring me up, and I'll make time for every one of you down the phone to give you a guide on what to ask for in your local area. Do you know, my time I give freely. My advice will cost you nothing, and it might save you a lot of money and a lot of heartache.
John O'Looney, thanks very much for joining us.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for listening.
So that was John O'Looney. That's his name. Yes, it really is. And he's a funeral director in Milton Keynes. Speaking to me earlier this week about some pretty, I mean, he's seen, hasn't he, a very, very unique way through this. And well done, John. Bless you, mate, for sticking your head above the parapet and saying what you've seen. Most people just think, oh, well, someone else's job to do that. But John hasn't done that, and he's been telling everyone what's going on. Particularly horrifying that we're now seeing this extra increase in the number of deaths around the country. What is due to that? Is there any real investigation, or are they just guessing when they say, oh, it's a side effect of the National Health Service being put under stress? So maybe it's actually potentially to do with the vaccines. Anyway, right, so on to our next item, and that was also another one recorded this week. It's a busy week for me, actually. Is this chat we're having with George Ferguson. It's called OurWordBristol.com. The former president of the Royal Institute for British Architects, or REBA, and former independent mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson, spells out his vision for the condemned to be sold off for luxury flats, Bristol Zoo. The Zoological Society, headed by the rather slippery Julian Morris, are threatening to cash in, saying they've got no choice. Well, of course they do. George has put together a team to make sure there is a choice.
George Ferguson, I was the directly elected mayor of Bristol most recently. I'm an architect and general social and cultural entrepreneur.
Now, you're one of the people who's been putting together this project, Our World Bristol, which is a vision for the zoo site, which they're talking about selling off. But what do you, as an architect, bring to this? Because I think a lot of it is about creating a place. Obviously, the zoo, for many Bristolians, is a fantastic place to be. And it's terrible. It's tragic that it's going to be out of walking distance. They're moving it away. How does this all link into your expertise as an architect?
Well, I always see myself primarily as an urbanist, a placemaker, and architects build objects, and placemakers make stuff happen. And I spent my life making things happen in appropriate places in cities, and I'm a strong believer in attractions being accessible to people, not being car dependent, being places that are part of a community. And so I've known the zoo all my life in Bristol for the past 55 years, and it's I've always found it an attractive place, but I think I've got an increasing distaste for zoos as they are. I think gawping at animals in cages is not the way forward. And I think the zoo understands that, and that's why they want to move. But I reacted pretty badly to the suggestion that the zoo should become yet another posh housing site in order to raise money to move the zoo out of town. And that's where it all started.
Well, why does it matter where the zoo is? Surely if it's near the motorway, it's going to be much more accessible to more people.
It's going to be more accessible to people with cars. It's going to be less accessible to people who live in the city and rely on public transport or cycling or walking even.
And tourists, I suppose, as well, in Clifton.
And tourists. Tourists are much more likely not... they're likely to arrive without a car. And so Clifton is already a tourist attraction. And this is probably one of the prime reasons why people come to this area of Bristol. It's also on the edge of the Downs, on the edge of the Gorge. It's a wonderfully biodiverse, rich area. And the zoo should be... A springboard for all that activity. The zoo should be a richly biodiverse garden. It's nearly 12 acres. It's a wonderfully mature garden. It was founded in 1835 by Henry Riley, a physician, who incidentally discovered the fourth dinosaur in the world before people even knew what dinosaurs were, before they had a name, on the edge of the Downs. So it has an amazing history. And then Henry Riley got Brunel in as one of the founding partners. It's the oldest provincial zoo in the world. It's the, you know, it's the first non-capital zoo in the world. It's the fifth zoo of any type in the world. It's a very, very precious thing. Of course, we need to reinvent. And so, rather than just being anti the idea of it becoming a posh housing development, I thought we should come up with an alternative. And we got a group of people together, other people who happened to be like-minded at the same time. We were thrown together and we have become the sponsors for what we call Our World Bristol, which is incredible bit of serendipity because it brings together people in this region, in the southwest region, who have all the expertise to produce this new vision of a zoo.
What I'm sure Justin Morris, the current zoo director, will be saying is, I'm afraid this old model of the provincial zoo, great and ancient though it is, just isn't financially viable anymore.
That's right, and that's why you have to be more imaginative. I mean, they're relying on advice from KPMG and, you know, big accountants and property agents. Nothing really interesting has happened in the world that relies on the advice of big accountants and property agents. And so, you know, we're thinking the art of the impossible. Eden was the Eden project was the art of the impossible. There are so many, you know, the what's now called We the Curious would never have happened if we'd just listened to the accountants. You know, so many of the wonderful projects that have happened in this city, in this country, in this world, are the result of people thinking out of the box. So this is thinking out of the box, but together with people in Bristol University, in the BBC Natural History Unit, in our local theatres. We've got film directors involved. Stephen Daldry, who is the director of The Crown, and Billy Elliot and other things, is one of the prime movers. We've got educators involved, the Cabot Learning Project, that runs some of the academies, Cabot Learning Federation, Boom Satsuma, which is creative education for secondary and higher education. So we have a fantastic group of people involved. We've got foodies involved because I see that you know, food must be at the heart of many things we do, and food education is really important. Got climate scientists involved. So and we've got people with money and people who are prepared to put money into something that they believe is that the time is right for, especially at all the discussion that's going on about the threats to biodiversity across the
world. They're going to be sticking their necks out, these people. This sort of thing hasn't really been done much before, has it? I suppose, you know, it's the same sort of spirit that put the zoo there back in the 1800s in the first place.
Exactly the same spirit. And it fits their purposes. The zoo trustees are saying to us, yeah, but our purpose now is to raise as much money from the sites as we possibly can by whatever means in order to be able to invest it in what invested in their new project. I think their prime purpose should be putting the site that they've inherited from 1835 to best possible use. That should be their prime purpose.
So is it their land or are they leasing it?
It's their land. So we have to a certain extent, work with them. We have talked about collaboration, and we've had some good meetings with them, but they are still charging ahead. They've with their housing plan, they've appointed architects, good architects, but nevertheless, it's a matter of principle. You know, a better designed housing estate is only fractionally better than a badly designed housing estate. It's having a housing estate at all on this very precious historic site seems philistine to me.
We are losing a lot of shared spaces, aren't we, around the city, all over the city.
This is public space by all, you know, maybe owned by the zoo trustees and the shareholders, but it is to all intents and purposes a public space, and it's you know, it's one of the things that defines this city. And we can't sell out everything. This is, you know, we don't want to asset strip Bristol. We want to invest in the things that are that the people of Bristol value. And I know that it's been inaccessible to a lot of the people of Bristol. I think it's really important that a zoo for tomorrow is much more accessible. It's accessible to the schools, it's accessible to the people who can't afford to pay the sort of prices that you have to pay to go into the zoo, that it should be layered in its use so that it can be used at different times of day for different purposes, that involves other organisations. Bristol is the Hollywood of natural history filmmaking. More than half of the natural history filming of the world happens in Bristol. I don't think we champion that enough, that this could be very much a base for that. We have Wild Scream, we have so much to do with animal life in Bristol. To take that, the heart of that, out of Bristol seems so wrong. And so this is an opportunity to do so much more than the zoo currently does and be much more immersive. I mean, I wonder what gawping at an animal in a cage does for education. I don't think it does very much.
Well, there's a lot of people our age, George, brought up in Bristol. So many school trips will have been to that zoo to do exactly that, to gawp at the animals.
Absolutely. And I think we probably enjoyed it, but we've moved on. You know, we've moved on from in terms of understanding that animals are sentient beasts, that are currently in Parliament, they're debating that. And we need to have more respect for animals and their lives.
Now, okay, well, just can you take us through this whole idea of, the zoo of tomorrow? What would it look like? I mean, the idea of digital animals? Or, you know, that does sound a little bit peculiar.
No, real animals, first of all, that are attracted by the wild place that they're in. I use wild place, funnily enough, that's the term that the zoo uses out in their new zoo. But digital digitizing is another layer. So what we want is a highly biodiverse garden that attracts the bees, the bugs, the butterflies, the birds, the pond life, the creepy crawlies. So small animals that are naturally attracted or kept in that place because they want to be in that place, because of the plants, because of the nature of the place, then that is layered over by augmented reality that uses the place but enables people to imagine or even to experience being a bee in a beehive or being a caterpillar with the caterpillars. So the technology for that is being developed by a project called My World at the University of Bristol, which is a massive project. Bristol is at the heart of this development of these new technologies. It also would enable you to travel in time, so not only in scale but also in time, so you could be on the downs, which are adjacent to the zoo, prior to the Ice Age. You could... Mammoths used to walk across the downs, so the, you know, they have been discovered on the downs. The gorge was formed in the Ice Age, you know, so you could experience all those things. That is much, much more of a learning project than wandering around a zoo and, as I say, gawping at animals behind bars.
Okay, well, this sounds like an interesting new sort of technology, but it could really be anywhere. It doesn't have to be there, does it? It could be, you know, down in the city centre, you know, by the docks. It could be anywhere.
I think it could be adapted to any place, but there is something about the history of place, the location, the fact that it is by the downs, part of the Avon Gorge, that you can use the place. The whole difference with augmented reality and pure virtual reality is that augmented reality uses the place. It makes it much more interesting. If you were just in a warehouse down in St. Phillips behind the station, for instance, it would be pure virtual reality. You would have to you would have to create the habitat in which these things happen within that virtual reality. Augmented reality enables you to use the place. Another technology we're looking at is connecting to habitats across the world. So, and again, this could, to a certain extent, happen from any place. So we're not arguing that this is unique to this place, but this place is unique, and it would create a particularly special first version of this alternative zoo. And we say a first version because we think this is much more than about Bristol. We do think that this is going to be the answer to the future of zoos across the world, or an answer to zoos across the world. And let's hope that they're diverse and different, but they make use of the place they're in so that they are distinctive rather than just anywhere experiences.
It's almost, you know, you could probably do that sort of thing at home as well if you were going to do complete virtual reality. But anyway, I approached Justin Morris at the zoo to ask him, you know, what his plans are for the site and what he thought about this project. He didn't want to be interviewed.
Well, that is... yeah, as you know, I'm always up for being interviewed because I think you shouldn't hide.
At the end of the day, this is his decision. It sounds to me as if he's already going ahead, he's ignoring others, and he's just going to go ahead with the move out to the M5. And in a way, you know, it's a great proposal, but it doesn't sound as if the zoo are really interested.
The zoo are interested in getting planning permission to build, I think it's 340 apartments on the site. In no way are those going to be affordable apartments. I think it's the planning decision is the councillor's decision. The planning in this city is run, as it is in most local authorities, by planning departments that report to planning committees. The planning committees make the decision, not the mayor. The planning committees are quasi-judicial committees. They make the decision in the best interests of the people of Bristol. So I think it's up to them. If they decide it's in the best interest of the people of Bristol to build a housing estate on that on the zoo.
It's got to get what's called a change of use, isn't it? It's completely changing the use. So there's this is actually quite an obstacle through the planning system that they've still got to go through.
It is a huge obstacle. So while the zoo might decide that's what they want to do, in effect it will be the planners that decide whether that's legitimate or not. If they decide it's legitimate, then the site becomes worth, say, £40 million. If they decide it's not legitimate and something like ours as or other alternatives are the way forward, then the site is probably worth at most half as much, £15 or £20 million. We have people who would be willing to consider the purchase of the site at that sort of value, but not at an inflated housing value site. And so I think the key decision is going to be the planning decision. And, you know, in the end, I will respect that decision. But I do think that councillors are likely to ask themselves, now, what is in the best interests of Bristol as a city, the people of Bristol in particular, and people in general, and biodiversity and the environment in general. So I think, there's a heavy weight on the planning committee in making this decision.
A couple of other things you're looking at here are that Humanimal is one of the titles I see on your prospectus here, and also the Tyne Bridge. Can you tell us a bit about those?
Well, the Humanimal is a funny term that was invented by Tom Morris, who is the director of Bristol Old Vic. And Tom felt very strongly that we need to look at the relationship between humans and animals, and what are the things that bring us together and what are the things that separate us, and what about if you turn the tables between animals and humans?
Let the humans out in the lion's pen or something.
I think there's a lot of interesting things. You can do that virtually too. So you could play games. That's the whole thing with the sort of technology we're talking about. One could play those sort of games. So you could experience what it would have been like being a big cat in a cage, or a gorilla in a cage, or in a glass house, or whatever it might be. So Humanimal is about exploring that relationship. The Tyne Bridge is about looking, travelling in time. And that doesn't just mean travelling backwards, it can also mean travelling forwards. Why, you know, what would the world look like in 50 years' time if bees were extinct? So exploring the what-ifs, which is, you know, is as educational as you can get. It's it can be dramatic. And, you know, I think we're seeing some of the effects of man's stupidity happening now. But being able to see what that looks like in 20, 50, 100 years' time, I think, is more likely to be a wake-up call.
It's climate modelling, I suppose. That's what you're doing.
To a certain extent, yeah. And we can draw in the scientists and the naturalists and people to help us with that exploration.
Well, one of the best known people who's contributed to this proposal is Alice Roberts. So she is a TV personality, does history programs on television. What drew her to the project?
Well, she was immediately responsive. With a brief conversation, she thought, this is absolutely wonderful. It's educational, it's environmentally friendly, and it is more likely to attract people's interest going forward into the future than zoos as they are today. And she's somebody who is a patron of a zoo. She understands absolutely the importance of the education and the conservation that comes out of zoos, but we feel that sometimes that and she shares this, that sometimes the claims for conservation are exaggerated. I know, I mean, I don't want to put words into her mouth, but I think that we could do so much more for conservation than is the current experience. So She, as a Bristolian, as somebody who really cares about the area, who cares about animals, who cares about the environment and biodiversity, is a natural to be a champion for this, and she's a very willing champion.
Given that this is the decision which is going to be taken by the zoo, not by the group that's put this Our World Bristol proposal together, do you think if they do knock it back, do you think it's almost got a kind of momentum of its own, that it may happen in the city somewhere else anyway?
I think what we're doing, the work we're doing, and we've been doing since the end of last year, I think is always going to be valuable. We feel that what we're doing is not wasting time. Anything we do to influence the zoo gardens into becoming something better than a housing estate is a win. But the big win is to be able to deliver this project as we currently see it. But this project is developing. It's not, I mean, I would like to say that this is a preliminary prospectus that we have produced, because it's one of those things that will always change. And that is the great attraction, because so many attractions you don't get back to because they're the same as they were last time you went. And I think the great thing about an attraction based on the sort of principles that this is based on is that it will be forever different.
So how do people keep track of this project? What's the best place to look to find it, George?
Well, we have a website, ourworldbristol.com. So it's called Our World, but Our World Bristol, Bristol is a good brand, and it locates it. So ourworldbristol.com is the place to go and register an interest, to leave a comment, we will be updating the website. But also listening to your program, listening to the local media, seeing the looking at what's happening on social media, and hopefully we will make this into a bit of a national story, because I think it has national and international relevance.
Finally, the big story kind of behind this is the way that land's being sold off. I mean, just driving down here today, I see public toilets all closed up, looking to be either leased or sold. A lot of the role of the city council seems to be diminishing.
I think that's sadly true. I mean, we're very centrally governed in this country. And central government likes to blame local authorities for any failures, and the best way of blaming them is to keep them short of cash, and rather than keeping central government short of cash. And so it looks as if local government is failing, and I'm afraid we are the amongst the poorest of European nations in terms of local government. So, for instance, in France, they have local mayors are much stronger mayors, in that they have the resources to put in tramway systems, to do things that we simply cannot do in most of our cities. So, local government is unable to do those things that I believe it should be for sometimes. And selling off of public utilities is a criminal waste, unless it is in aid of creating something better. Now, the zoo may not belong to local government, it may not belong to Bristol City Council, but it is public in that it does belong in a very real sense to the people of Bristol, and I think should be considered as a public facility and should continue as a public facility into the future.
George Ferguson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Well, I mean, I found that absolutely fascinating, because it goes into so many things. The world's first ever provincial zoo being sold off for luxury flats. Quite obviously why the Bristol Zoological Society are doing that. And it's got nothing to do with the fact that they can't carry on doing what they're doing there. They obviously want to move it up to the M5. But also, what about all this, the side issue there about property prices? Are people just trying to cash everything in?
Anyway, so that was George Ferguson, former mayor of Bristol, there talking to me earlier this week about Our World Bristol. And George is looking for not donations, but pledges of £1,000, that sort of amount of money, maybe £10,000, whatever, towards this new zoo project, which would give you a share in the new proposal. And of course, that is most likely. And also, if you look at the balance of the councillors, Bristol City Council at the moment, the parties, you've got Labour, Green, Lib Dem split. So really, it's going to be only the Labour Party on the planning committee that will be voting for the change of use from a zoo to luxury flats. So it could well be that by having an extra proposal, an alternative proposal, that this whole move will be blocked in the planning process by the excellent Our World Bristol Zoo proposal. And also, it would be a brilliant way of showcasing the talent that there is in the city for these kind of digital media. Anyway, so that is that for part one. We're going to hear some music now, and afterwards we'll be having another deep dive, I suppose. Oh, I hate that word, but looking into the plandemic. Thank you. So that is from, or that was and is, from 1977, the album Spirit of the Age, Hawkwind's song Spirit of the Age. And before that, what you heard from 1727 was Handel's Zadok the Priest. That is a piece of music used at the coronation of George II. Now, into a second hour, we're going to be looking particularly at COVID. But before we do that, I thought it'd be great to hear about some of the, I suppose, similar concerns which are voiced about, particularly about microwave radiation and 5G. So we're going to hear now from Nicholas Martin. Nicholas Martin is a local councillor, and he is he will tell you exactly where he's from and which local council he's in. But one of the things he's done is he's managed to get himself elected into politics as part of a political party. They've called themselves called Save Us Now, or SUN, S-U-N. Also, interestingly, he says that their website has been being interfered with, he says, by the intelligence services, but I would guess actually probably by the telecommunications industry interfering with their website if they've had problems with that. So let's have a listen initially, before we get into COVID, to Nicholas Martin now, spoke to a couple of weeks ago, and there will be a longer version of this up on our show page later in the week at thisweek.org.uk from Save Us Now.
Hey, my name is Nicholas Martin, and I'm a local councillor in Wokingham. And what happened was I wanted to contribute to the political debate in the country after my wife got severely affected by Wi-Fi, and then I researched the nature of Wi-Fi, and then I got involved in understanding the nature of 5G, and that took me on a tremendous journey, which has consumed a lot of my time, but I think it's a very, very worthwhile journey, because the media are not reporting the reality of 5G to the people. Certain people are very sensitive to Wi-Fi, and when we installed Wi-Fi, or I didn't actually install it, my wife installed it maybe 5-6 years ago, and after installing it, she got tingling in her hands and the legs and went to the doctor, and he said, oh, don't worry, it's nothing serious, ignore it, and she ignored it. And then a few years later, she couldn't get out of bed, and I had to take her to a hospital because she was completely paralyzed and found great difficulty in moving. And they gave her cortisone and morphine injections to dull the pain and cortisone injections to try and get her mobile. And then she was basically in a wheelchair for the next few weeks and months. And I researched this because I didn't like the feeling of what was going to happen, whether I would have to continue to push her around in the wheelchair until she died. And that didn't look a very optimistic prospect. So then I researched it and came across the work of Dr. Jerry Tennant and Dr. Martin Ball, and discovered that the microwave radiations, which Wi-Fi are, can create great disturbance in the body if people are sensitive to it. And what happens is that the cell membranes of the body, inside the body, have what's called low voltage gated calcium channels. And the microwave radiation interferes with these channels, opens them up too wide, and lets too many calcium ions from the blood into the cells of the body. And that
How do you know that it's the Wi-Fi that's causing this?
Well, that's quite easy, because we got rid of Wi-Fi and we run a wired system. We don't have Wi-Fi at all, and my wife is perfectly okay again.
Couldn't that just be coincidence?
I don't think it's coincidence at all when you research the physics of it. And when she goes into an environment of Wi-Fi, and I give you an experiment, she stayed with a friend of hers and couldn't get to sleep, and mentioned to her friend that she had difficulty in sleeping. And then her friend realized she left her Wi-Fi on and she switched it off. And she's extremely sensitive to Wi-Fi. And certain people are. And in fact, everybody is sensitive. It's just they might not be aware of it. It's a bit like smoking. Some people can smoke until they're 85, 95. Other people will drop dead at 25 after getting cancer. But nobody in the world thinks smoking is a healthy activity, and it's exactly the same with Wi-Fi. Jerry Tennant and Dr. Martin Paul, and Martin Paul is the professor emeritus at Washington State University, and he calls 5G an absolute insanity. And he goes into great detail about how microwave radiation, which is 2G, 3G, 4G, 5G, smart meters, Wi-Fi, all of that is microwave radiation. How it affects, as I was mentioning, these low-voltage gated calcium channels, which are well-known in medicine, by the way, even in conventional medicine, and opens them up too much and lets calcium in, too many calcium ions from the bloodstream into the cell, which triggers what he has discovered called peroxynitrites, a biochemical product in a biochemical reaction in the cell. And this causes inflammation throughout the body. Now, that's one aspect of Wi-Fi. He's detailed all the other aspects, and he's written many papers on it. And I really then realized that the government and the BBC and the media in general are not educating the people how to use these this technology without hurting themselves. And I think that's diabolical, and it made me very active in trying to make people aware. I think there are two things going on. What happened is that they installed a network of 5G throughout the streetlights in England. This was done under the pretext of global warming. And the UNIPCC, the policy that there is global warming caused by man, in other words, too much CO2 caused by man is creating global warming, which required the local councils to replace their old streetlights with new LED streetlights in the idea of using less energy. But inside those streetlights are small cell 5G antennae, which create a 5G network up and down the streets of the UK. Now, there are two aspects to these streetlights. The LED light itself is what's called blue light, around about 450 nanometer wavelength. And the British PHE, Public Health England, warned this that this light can cause macular degeneration and kill, for example, there's two leading scientists in the field. One is John Marshall from Moorfields Eye Hospital, and the other is a PHE scientist, John O'Hagan. Both of them have warned that this blue light can cause macular degeneration, which is a form of blindness in human beings. Yet the councils installed these lights with already, they were given this information by PHE. So it's quite remarkable that they would do that. Secondly, inside the streetlights are these small cell 5G antennae, and you need 5G antennae if you want to have things like driverless cars. And the nature of 5G is exactly what you say. It's a backhauling data. In other words, everything is connected to everything else. And you backhaul, that means collect the data from by a scanning process. The difference between 5G and 4G and the other Gs is that 5G is a beamform technology, and it scans the field like radar and picks up data and sends it back. In relation to your point about picking up biometric data, in other words, data from the body, if you listen to Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum, he wants people to become connected to the internet directly. In other words, not through your laptop, but yourself, you become part of the internet. And he calls this not the internet of things, but the internet of bodies. It's quite unbelievable.
Hang on, 5G is not being picked up by me, the body. It's being picked up by my phone. Actually, it doesn't. I don't happen to have a 5G phone, but you know, 5G is not. It's not going to be picked up by the body, and it's not going to transmit back to a 5G transmitter.
Well, I have to put you in the right direction there, Tony. 5G is a scanning technology. It's like a radar beam. It's a focus beam of energy. And that's the difference between 5G and 4G. your phone can only, a 4G phone can only backhaul to one device. 5G, because it's a beam, can scan the field and pick up data from many devices. In relation to the Klaus Schwab World Economic Forum, they want to put substances inside your body, which can then be picked up by the beam wave scanning. In other words, you can be connected directly to the internet. Now, they're quite open about this. You don't need your mobile phone anymore to pick up your own data. And that's what Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum want. My own local council, which is a small council and doesn't have ultimate decision on planning, but they do have, they are part of the planning process and they have to consider planning applications. When I first joined the council, they all thought I was body as a fruitcake. They don't think I'm body anymore. And the councillors, I think, are beginning to understand what I'm telling them. And I think everybody can understand that there are no insects coming up and smashing up, or very few, against your windscreen. And the death of the insects has been caused by the installation of these lights. And nobody wants to get macular degeneration. So these two aspects, the 5G small cell infrastructure and the nature of the blue light, I've explained to my colleagues, and I don't think they think I'm as dodgy as a fruitcake anymore.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, it's all too late. Surely, you know, you've got these masks up now. The telecommunications industry's got its way.
Yes, that's an extremely good point. If I can come back to the World Economic Forum, who want to get people connected directly to the internet. I mean, it's quite unbelievable. But if you look up Klaus Schwab and look up his statements, you'll see that he talks about the internet of bodies. And he's very similar in that respect to Elon Musk, who has a different version. He calls it the Neuralink, which is to connect your brain directly to the internet. Now, probably you and I would think these people are crackers, but this is what they want to do. Now, in the vaccines for corona are graphene oxide nanolipid lattices. Those nanolipid lattices are very small microchips, if you like. And when you've had vaccines, they can, the 5G beams, which are like scanning radar, can pick up your information. And you can actually, what's called, back all the information to other people. In other words, your biometrics can be read remotely. Now, this is the level of science which we're talking about, the level of technology, I should say, that most people have no idea about. Most people have no idea that Klaus Schwab wants to connect human beings to the internet. And most people don't know that the vaccines have these nanoparticles in them. Now, in addition to nanolattices, nanolipid lattices, they have nanotungsten in these vaccines and have done for many years, even in the flu vaccines. When these nanotungsten particles circulate in the body, they get through the blood-brain barrier because they're very small and lodge in the brain. And because of what is called the dielectric effect, they create a hot spot in your brain of microwave radiation. Now, these aspects are very dangerous to the human being. And I think when people realize what's going on and they become aware of it, they will demand that this network is disabled. And the reason I'm confident that will happen, if you think of what's happened to Prince Andrew, he, so far as I'm aware, has been in no court of law anywhere in the world, yet he cannot go round opening a Tesco in Bristol anymore. Sheer public opinion has kept him in a form of prison. In other words, the sheer power of public opinion is an extremely potent force. And when people realize what's going on in relation to the streetlights, in relation to the light of the LED itself, then they will demand that these things are taken down and replaced with safe technology. And I would like to say I'm not against technology. I'm totally in favor of it, but I'm not in favor of people being hurt by technology.
Can I ask you what party you're a councillor for?
Yes, certainly. I'm a party for a new, sorry, I'm a councillor for a new party called Save Us Now, Sun. And that was specifically created to take down 5G democratically and legally in the United Kingdom. Our party is growing, despite intelligence people trying to shut down our website and stop people donating and stop people joining it. We're still getting members coming along. In relation to stopping masks, I'm part of an action group where we've stopped, I would say, 40 or 50 masks from being accepted on banning application. And we're very, very active in trying to stop Matt Warman, who's in the Department of Digital Culture, Media and Sport, who wants to take away from the local authorities the planning permission powers that they've got to stop 5G masts. And that's a very, very serious damage to our democracy if he succeeds. And I hope that he won't, and we're doing our level best to try and stop his consultation becoming law in his attempts to emasculate the local councils from making planning decisions in relation to 5G masts.
So that was, you heard there from Nicholas Martin. Save Us Now is the political party, or Sun. Interesting to hear that he says he's having their website interfered with. We're going to go now to hear a bit, actually a short clip, shortish clip from Talk Radio earlier this week. The guy's name is Peter Impontifract. His staff had COVID-19 in November 2019, he says, all got over it, and he believes that the T-cell immunity that they have is the best there is. No problems with the Delta variant at his company, but the question is, and you're here now, will Richard Tice, who runs the Brexit Party, or whatever it's renamed itself as these days, and has been given a slot on Talk Radio at the weekends now, I think it's a three-hour programme, will Richard Tice on Talk Radio give Peter Impontifract a chance to make his point?
We've got Peter Impontifract. Tell us your thoughts on treatments and COVID.
Hello, good morning, Richard. Thank you for taking the call, and well done with the show. Nice to see a bit of common sense continuing through Talk Radio. I've always been a fan.
Thank you.
It was a point I wanted to make with yourself as a sort of a fresh player in this. Just a reset button required, I think. The point I'm trying to make, really, first of all, is we ought to re-separate coronavirus from COVID-19. One is a virus, the other is a disease, which develops or may or may not develop subsequently to finding you catch the virus. And the language has been irritatingly manipulated, I think.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? You can't catch a disease. You can't.
Well, let's and Peter, what's your background? Are you a doctor, or are you?
No, I'm a businessman.
Right, and you're a manufacturer.
I'm a manufacturer in Bradford. All our staff, 146 of them, all caught what we thought was that year's bad flu and bronchial infection in November and December 2019. We've got six factories in China, staff returning every 2 or 3 days. We developed what we thought was just that year's disease. We all got over it. We're all between 30 and 60, myself included.
Yeah.
We got it, got over it.
Exactly. Because, of course, COVID essentially, I mean, COVID is, you know, there are a number of coronaviruses of which, COVID is one. And it's about, I mean, ultimately, it's a crisis that Withers have been talking about with vaccines and treatments. We have to learn to live with it. It feels to me, Peter, that the language has been, amongst all the anxiety, the language has been too slow that we've got to find ways to learn to live with this. And it sounds like you're on that page.
Richard, it's not so long ago that Chris Whitty announced and told us about SARS-CoV-2, the virus. He then went on to say it takes 19 to 23 days to develop into D, COVID, the disease. They're separate. They're related, but they're separate. The best immunity you can get is to catch coronavirus, develop your own T-cell and antibody immunity, and get over it. From that point on, you are immune.
Exactly. I mean, well, look, Peter, the thing is, obviously, on a talk show, if one's not a medic, a doctor, you know, we can't give medical advice, but we can talk about, in a sense, the benefits of the benefits of treatments. We can talk about the vaccines, different people, different ways out of this, and you know, how we give confidence to people. And it's interesting, you know, you as a manufacturer, your staff being ill so early in this crisis, essentially before we knew there was a crisis, because you've got people coming back from China. Fascinating insight there. Thank you, Peter. But I just caveat the whole treatment thing. Obviously, you shouldn't take any medication unless it's been prescribed by a medical professional.
So, did you see what he did there? Just closed the whole discussion down, interrupted him slowly but surely. He's saying treatment, treatment. This is one of the reasons that the broadcasters are all being told to get very, very nervous about anyone talking about treatment of COVID, is because the fact that there is treatment out there is extremely dangerous for the vaccine companies. They know something, don't they? What do they know? They know that they got their emergency use authorization because they said in this declaration that the government signed, they signed, and everyone else signed, the reason they managed to get that emergency use authorization was one little clause in there said there must be no other treatment. So any other treatment, I'm afraid, is taboo, is being censored, etc., etc. And that's what's going on, folks. And people are dying, no doubt, as a result of treatment for COVID being censored by people like Richard Tice. But I think balance, I think Peter in Pontefract did manage to get most of his points across, even though he was rather rudely and slowly and patronisingly shut down by Richard Tice. Anyway, we've just had someone come over to our tent here at Brancaster Car Park. We're from the Royal West Norfolk Golf Club, Beach Road, Brancaster, PE318AX, with a nice little crown on the top. And that is from 1892. Apparently, the Royal West Norfolk Golf Club was formed. And they bought this land, they told me earlier on, in 1927, and they have the deeds, although nobody around here has actually seen them. Maybe they're telling the truth, who knows? Anyway, they're saying, you have received a copy of this letter following your attendance at Brancaster Beach Car Park. The Royal West Norfolk Golf Club are the legal registered owners of the car park. This is what the welcome that the Royal West Norfolk Golf Club are giving to people who are turning up here. They say they've not given permission for the event to be held or any access to the car park for this purpose. Well, actually, people can park their cars here for whatever they want. I mean, they don't just have to go. They can sit in their cars and go nowhere if they want. So the golf club, this is obviously a solicitor's letter, which has been drafting. The golf club therefore considers the event, that's us here, to be unlawful. There are specific restrictions on any person, including a common right holder, using common land for camping at events, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, that's the rather silly, ridiculous, infantile letter that the solicitors for Royal West Norfolk Golf Club, who seem to like, just that's their solution to everything, will pay a solicitor to send a letter to people. And they've actually now got some guy who's part of the security for the golf club, even though there's hardly anybody left in the car park now, coming over to everybody that turns up here and giving them one of these little letters. So they're obviously interested in spending money on this. Anyway, on to more on COVID. And Noah in the Bible was a conspiracy theorist until it rained. A poison death shot. That's how Dr. Vladimir Zelenko, President Trump's doctor, and amongst many others, wealthy people and powerful people around the world he's treated, describes the COVID vaccines to follow to fellow Jews in the Israeli government. So he is himself Jewish, and he's talking to a lot of Jews over in Israel. He takes them through what he believes is the biggest risk of genocide since the Holocaust. Strong words. But he's not alone. Dr. Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of HIV and AIDS, agrees. It is the biggest risk of mass genocide since the Holocaust. An unprecedented suppression of treatments, psychological pressure, coercion, and now force to compel people to get what he calls the poison death shot. The CDC whistleblower says there have already been 45,000 deaths, as you're about to hear, in the United States. So let's hear now for about 25 minutes from Dr. Vladimir Selenko, former President Trump's former doctor, or maybe even a present doctor, who knows, talking to the Israeli government about COVID vaccines.
Dr. Vladimir Selenko. Dr. Selenko is a board-certified family physician for over 20 years. He has been described by his patients as a family member to thousands of families, and is a medical advisor to the Volunteer Ambulance Corps in Kiryas Joel, New York. Dr. Selenko developed his now famous Selenko Protocol, which has saved countless lives worldwide. So welcome, Dr. Selenko. Thank you for joining us. And I would like you to comment on our subject, please.
Thank you so much for having me. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Very good. So I'll just give you quickly my experience. My team has directly treated successfully 6,000 patients. I've trained hundreds of physicians who are now training their students. And as a cumulative group, we've treated millions of patients successfully. President Trump was my patient. Rudy Giuliani was my patient. Reb Chaim Konevsky has been my patient. Mr. Litzman, your health minister of Israel last year, was my patient. I'm just telling you which people have contacted me for care, and including President Bolsonaro of Brazil. Now, my experience has given me a very unique perspective in approaching COVID-19, which is basically keeping people out of the hospital. I would like to describe, regarding children, the only reason you would want to treat a child is if you believe in child sacrifice, or even the voters are. If you want to be mocked of children, like a carbon, it's a very good reason to give them the shot. Otherwise, there's no necessity. Let me explain. Anytime you evaluate any therapeutic, you need to look at it from three perspectives. Is it safe? Does it work? And do you need it? Just because you have a capability doesn't mean that you have to use it. There has to be a medical necessity. There has to be a need for it. You look at the CDC, the statistics for children under the age of 18 that are healthy, the survival rate is 99.998% survival rate with no treatment. Just like Dr. Yudin said, the influenza virus is more dangerous to children than COVID-19. And he made an estimate that per million, 100 children would die from the vaccination. I feel the number would be significantly higher, and I'll explain to you the rationale for it. So if you have a demographic, can you hear me?
We hear you excellent, doctor.
If you have a demographic that has no risk of dying from an illness, why would you inject them with a poison death shot? Now, let's see if this thing works. The two countries in the world that are most vaccinated its citizens is Israel, a high 85% rate of vaccination, and an island nation in the Indian Ocean called Seychelles, also over 80%. Both countries are experiencing a Delta variant outbreak. So let me ask you a question. If you vaccinated the majority of your population, why are you still having an outbreak? That's number one. Number two, why would you even give a third shot of the same stuff that didn't work the first two times? All right, that's whether or not it works. And let's talk about safety. Now, this is the real issue. There are three levels of safety or death that we need to look at. One is acute, one is subacute, and long-term. Acute, I'll define from the moment of injection till 3 months. The number one risk of the shot is blood clots, just like Dr. Yudin said, according to the Salk Institute. By the way, everything I'm saying, I will defend with documentation. And please don't take my word for it. You should do your due diligence. And I can provide to you proof for everything that I'm saying. According to the Salk Institute, when a person gets an injection of these vaccines, quote unquote, the body becomes a spike-producing factory making trillions of spikes, which migrate to the endothelium, which is the inner lining of your blood vessels, and it's basically little thorns on the inside of your vasculature. As the blood cells flow through it, they get damaged, they cause blood clots. If that happens in the heart, it's a heart attack. If that happens in the brain, that's a stroke. So we're seeing the number one cause of death in the short term is from blood clots, and most of it is happening within the first 3-4 days. 40% is happening within the first 3 days of injection of this poison death shot. Now, the other problem is that it's causing myocarditis or inflammation in the hearts of children, and young adults, I'm sorry, in the hearts of young adults. And the third problem, which is the most disturbing, is according to the New England Journal of Medicine article, their preliminary data, the miscarriage rate in the first trimester, woman gets vaccinated in the first trimester goes from 10% to 80%. I want you to understand what I just said. The miscarriage rate in the first trimester of pregnant women when they get vaccinated goes up by a factor of 8. That's preliminary data. It may change with time, but I'm just telling you what it is as of today. That's the smallest of the problem. The second problem is the subacute death issue, which is the following, that the animal studies that were done with these vaccines showed that all the animals responded well in generating antibodies. When they were challenged, however, with the virus that they were immunized against, a large percentage of them died. And when that was investigated, it was found that their immune system had killed them. It's called something antibody-dependent enhancement or pathogenic priming, or paradoxical immune enhancement. But the point is that a lot of those animals died. So you can make an argument, maybe human beings are different. My answer to you, maybe. However, those studies were not done. You are the study right now. The Pfizer CEO said Israel is the biggest laboratory in the world. And so those long-term studies to rule out Dr. Luke Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for the discovery of HIV, said that this is the biggest risk to humanity and the biggest risk of genocide in the history of humanity. And so the risk of a ADE reaction in human beings, which happens later, has not been ruled out. So my question is, why would I vaccinate someone with a potentially destructive, lethal substance without ruling that out first? And the third component here is the long-term consequences. There is definite evidence that it affects fertility, damages ovarian function, that it reduces sperm counts, number one. Number two, definitely increases the amount of autoimmune diseases. Who knows over time how that is going to reduce lifespan? And just last week, a paper came out showing that increases the risk of cancer. So any way you want to look at it, whether in the acute setting where it causes blood clots, inflammation of the heart, and miscarriages, in the midterm subacute setting where it can result in a pathological, disastrous immune reaction, or in the long term, whether it causes increased autoimmune diseases, cancer, and infertility. Now, that's a big concern. Actually, I will say it this way. In my opinion, the current Israeli government is a Gilgul of Joseph Mengele. They have permitted human experimentation on their own people. And I'm going to tell you, I hope this basin is a little different, maybe not, but I know I finally understood what Chazal say, that if you see Tzuras and Klal Yisrael, you should look at the Dayan Yisrael, Masechta Shabbos. That if you see trouble in the Jewish people, yes, you should look at the rabbinic leadership, because if the head is diseased, what do you expect of the body? So I beg of this basin to put the interests of Klal Yisrael above politics and anything else that may alter your opinions. I received daily death threats. I risked my life, my career, my financial life, my reputation, my almost my family, everything, just to sit here and tell you what I'm telling. So I'll just summarize it, that there is no need for this vaccine. And there's actually no need for anyone. And I'll explain. Children, I already told you, they have a 99.998% chance of getting better. Young adults from 18 to 45 have a 99.95% of getting better. This is according to the CDC, same concept. Someone who has already COVID and has antibodies, naturally induced immunity is a billion times more effective than artificially induced immunity through vaccine. So why would I vaccinate someone with a poison death shot that makes inferior or dangerous antibodies when I already have healthy antibodies? And then if you look at the high risk population that has a 7.5% death rate, so my data, which was the first in the world, which I published in a peer-reviewed journal, which has become the basis of over 200 other studies, and that have corroborated my observations that if you treat people in the right time frame, you reduce death rate by 85%. So out of 600,000 Americans, we could have prevented 510,000 from going to the hospital and dying. And by the way, I presented this information to Bibi Netanyahu directly into his hands by way of a shliach in April of 2020. And I informed every single member of your Ministry of Health as well. So my question to you is, if I can reduce the death rate from 7.5% to less than 0.5%, why would I use a poison death shot that doesn't work and has tremendous and horrific side effects? And I'll do one more mind experiment with you. If everyone on the planet were to get COVID and not get treated, the death rate globally will be less than 0.5%. Now, I'm not advocating for that. That's a lot of people. That's 35 million people would die. However, if we follow the advice of some of the quote-unquote global leaders, let's say like Bill Gates said last year, 7 billion people need to be vaccinated, the death rate will be over 2 billion people. So wake up. This is World War III. This is a level of malfeasance and malevolence that we have not seen probably in the history of humanity. So I'm against child sacrifice. I'm against Avodah Zarah. And I really believe that God is testing every human being here. And here's the test. Are you going to bow down to me, to Hashem? Are you going to ask for your protection from me? Are you going to take your fears and ask me to help? Or are you going to run to the Avodah Zarah, the Eagle Hazav of the vaccine, of your governments, of despots and tyrants like sociopaths, wannabe deities? There's nothing new under the sun. These people are no different than Paro. They think they're God. And you're going to bow down to them. If you're going to bow down to them, let them protect you. Let's see how that's going to work out for you. I've seen fear drive people to do things that are completely irrational, do not make sense, and they sacrifice their own children. And yes, your Ministry of Health is lying to you. Your statistics are absolutely skewed. If you want to see something real, there's a website called worldmeters.info. Go to Israel, and you can see at December 20th, there's a huge spike in the curve of death in Israel. Do you know what happened in Israel December 20th? National immunization started. And these are numbers being reported by the Israeli government. They're just too stupid to hide it. There is zero justification for using this poison death shot, unless you want to sacrifice human beings. World experts are saying that if you look at Dr. Malone, who invented the mRNA technology, has the original patents for the vaccine, he's saying, do not use this. The government is lying to you. The side effects are horrific. Dr. Cahill from Ireland said that she believes that within 2 years, 90% of the people that got vaccinated will be dead. When Dr. Michael Yidden, I hope you can confirm, I hope he's still there, was asked that question, he said he wouldn't go that far. So I don't know, maybe it's not 90%. What is the percentage? And maybe it's not 2 years, maybe it's 3 years. And Dr. Luke Montague, who is the Nobel Prize winner for the discovery of HIV, saying this is the biggest risk of genocide in the history of humanity. And I've treated over 6,000 patients. So you have to know who you're talking to. And I have no negias except the loss of my life. Now, what I'm going to tell you is the following. That yes, there's been a very coordinated effort to suppress life-saving information. Drugs like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, which are the safest medications in the history of medicine, have been suppressed, and you can't even get them in Israel. Doctors who dare to say something that is against the narrative are being deplatformed, including world experts, like Dr. Malone, for example, who developed the mRNA vaccine, said something against the narrative, was deplatformed from every media platform. Can you tell me why? And then can you tell me why there is suppression of knowledge of side effects about this poison death shot? And then tell me why there's this incredible coercion, psychological pressure, and now using force to compel people to take the shot. You should be answering that question, not me. There is a coordinated effort here. And Israel's leading the way. There's data shows as of today, 11,000 dead people and 450,000 adverse events. First of all, that's not enough. What's your threshold of death?
No, and that's already, one.
Okay, one. Theirs is already admitting to that. There's a CDC whistleblower that just said it's not 11,000, but it's 45,000. That's not enough. And then there's a 2009 Harvard study that said only 1% of actual events are reported. Now, I can make an argument that perhaps rashes are reported at a much lower rate than death. So for the benefit of the doubt, let's say 20% of deaths are being reported. And I'm being very generous. So if you take 45,000, according to the whistleblower, or even if you take 11,000 to what they admit, so the number is either 50,000, it's like the Haggadah, 50,000 or 200,000, you choose. And then there are two other problems with theirs. I have colleagues that lost patients from the vaccine. They try to file reports. The system rejects their reports for no reason. And is the other problem, and I have evidence for this as well, that reports that were filed are now being scrubbed off the system and you can't even find them. So even if you, by the way, this is not a conspiracy theory, it's a conspiracy, not a theory. You know, 18 months ago, if I would have told you that COVID-19 is a bioweapon, you would say I'm a conspiracy theorist. You know, Noah in the Bible was a conspiracy theorist until it rained. So right now, if I tell you that this is an artificially made bioweapon, it's a conspiracy, but not a theory. Everyone agrees that this is artificially made. And I know exactly when it was made, and I know the patent numbers associated with the modifications. In 1999, Dr. Ralph Barrett at the University of North Carolina modified a bat coronavirus on a surface protein in order that it should infect human beings. Then that research became illegal in America. It got sent by the American taxpayer dollars and by Fauci to Wuhan, where that research continued until they figured out a way to modify this virus to make it extremely more destructive to human lungs and to cause blood clots. So they took a naturally occurring virus and slowly made two changes to it over time. It took them 22 years to 20 years to modify that it should infect humans, and then when it does infect humans, that it should destroy a tissue. Now, no one's saying I'm a conspiracy theorist. People are saying it's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy to commit genocide. It's so hard for Jewish people to believe that there could be a group of people willing to destroy. It's a war against God. There's two ways of looking at life. Either you look at a human being is made in the image of God. If you're made in the image of God, that means your life has sanctity. If your life has sanctity, then you have human rights. And if you have human rights, it's not your business or my business to decide how many people should be on the planet and who should live or die. Right? The other system, the Darwin eugenic system, but it actually goes back to Cain. But that system says basically who's on top of the dominance hierarchy of life, those that have the biggest survival benefit. That inevitably leads to three categories of people, the Übermensch, the Mensch, and the Untermensch. If you apply that 80 years ago, the Übermensch were these Nazis, Yimach Shemai, who were descendants of Aryan gods, who felt it was in their prerogative, their right, to decide who lives or dies. So the Menschen, which were the Anglo-Saxons, the Europeans, could live and be slaves. And the Untermenschen, the Jews, the Slavs, handicapped, gypsies, political prisoners, those needed to become dust. So it sounds like a fairy tale, except that it killed 200 million people. And it's the same exact thing now, except that it's not anti-Semitic. Right now, it's a completely different. There's a group of people that feel that they've evolved into a higher level of consciousness, that in their new intelligence and insight allows them to determine these things. I don't think they evolved. I think they're devolved pagans. I think they've become the mamash what the Torah calls these avodah zarahniks from before, Baal Peor or Molech. There's no difference from them.
I understand, but let's not. We just want the CDC itself is also Mr. Biden is also running a vaccination program. Also, I'm against the program, but you know, you can scream over here, but your people in America there are 200 million people who took the vaccines. I'm sorry, that's all.
So then, let me tell you about the CDC. President Trump made an executive order that every single American should have access to hydroxychloroquine. That order went to Health and Human Services, Secretary Azar, and that eventually ended up at the CDC by Dr. Rick Bright. And what Dr. Rick Bright did, instead of using the right to try legislation that would have made access to this medication to every American and every human being around the world, because the biggest complaint I got from Israel was, well, your CDC, your FDA is not approving it, because especially the Israeli government are mamish puppets to whatever the Americans do. So because the Americans weren't willing to do it, Israel wasn't willing to do. And so what did they do? They created an executive use authorization that restricted and limited access to only hospitalized patients, effectively cutting it off from patients in the outpatient setting at home. This has been documented by Dr. Rick Bright himself in a documentary called Totally Under Control. These are not my words, those are his words. And furthermore, then they took away the emergency use authorization of hydroxychloroquine, and they used the Lancet study that showed that hydroxychloroquine kills people. The problem with that study was that it was fraud. And the Lancet had to retract that study because it was based on data that didn't exist. But the FDA and the CDC used that study after it was retracted to revoke the emergency use authorization. And the reason why is that if a drug has emergency use authorization, other drugs can't. And 3 weeks later, remdesivir, made by Gilead Pharmaceuticals, received an emergency use authorization and a $3 billion contract. And remdesivir showed no benefit. It reduced hospital stay by 5 days, but with no survival benefit, and cost $3,200 a patient and IV. The drugs that I was using was cost 20 cents a pill at home and reduced death and hospitalization by 84%. That means it reduced the market share for remdesivir by 84%. So the CDC is not an authority to me. You know, according to the NIH right now, you're not supposed to treat COVID unless you're in the hospital and your oxygen is less than 92%. Now, this is a advice and recommendations of a government that wants you to die. After 18 months and dozens of studies that have shown an 85% on average benefit of healing, avoiding hospitalization and death, and you have a government agency still making that recommendation, they've completely lost all credibility. Yes, our governments are corrupt. Yes, our governments have conspired. Do you know, if I was organizing this, I would come to a world leader. I would come to Bibi or Bennett and say, listen, quiet. Here is $500 million. I'll put it in an account that you'll know, no one could trace. Just listen to us. And if you don't, we're going to kill your family. By the way, if you look historically, right, 20% of the Yidden left Mitzrayim, they say, one shitta. And then there was the Dor Midbar that died, a certain percentage, right? So I don't know, 50%, let's say. So only 1 out of 10 Jews left Egypt and made it to Israel. What that means is only 10% of our people are capable of making the psychological transition, from slavery to redemptive thinking. That's what the problem is here. It's a collision of two systems that cannot coexist. A God-centered consciousness versus avodah zarah. Nothing new is under the sun. It's all the same thing. It's just the battlefield now is COVID-19.
So that was, well, it's a chap called Dr. Vladimir Selenko giving a presentation there to many of the members of the Israeli government, including the Israeli health minister. I'm not sure quite when that was, tail end of last week, fairly recently anyway, I believe. So anyway, I've only just come across that. Thank you, by the way, for everyone that shares your interesting links, and particularly those videos like that one with me. And also this week, you know, for the funeral director that we spoke to exclusively, all these things we can only do if you tell me about them. And so please do email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. Now, we're living in unprecedented times, in case you hadn't realised that at the moment. And so what with the mass media behaving so treacherously as it is, then we do need to keep lines of communication going. So please do email me any interesting stuff you've got, you think that I should be covering at thisweek.org.uk. So we're going to continue on by looking at COVID a little bit more. And now with Dr. Carrie Madday. She is one of the originals from the American Frontline Doctors. And here she takes a look at the idea of human 2.0. or transhumanism. Now, I've heard many people refer to this as the modern form of fascism. Well, you could probably certainly link it up with eugenics, that's for sure. And it's a kind of diseased idea that we can just simply genetically engineer humans into any kind of which way we want, and everything's going to be wonderful. Now, one of the things, factual things I know about this, for example, the CRISPR technology, which is the gene editing technology done by Emmanuel Charpentier from the Bilderberg conferences. Some of you following this will know quite a lot about her. We met her back in 2016, a group of us, including Charlie Skelton, at the Bilderberg conference back in 2016, and started chatting to her about her work on the gene editing technology. Then started talking to her about designer babies, at which point she turned on our heels and suddenly security appeared out of nowhere. Anyway, transhumanism, the modern version of the 20th century eugenicist ideology, creating a digital master race. This is what they want, apparently, or maybe it's just a cover for something else, and programming humanity to become happy digital slaves, wiping the disabled people out before they're even born. So this Dr. Carrie Madday now.
This is the plan for all of us. This is the plan for everybody around the world. It has something to do with a topic called transhumanism, which is also known as Human 2.0. So what is that? I alluded to that a little bit earlier. It's literally the melding of your human, organic, natural-born body with artificial intelligence. They believe when we do this that it can be fantastic for everybody. It's a very futuristic way of becoming a human. Just if you wanted to learn a new language, you would just be downloaded into your brain and voila, you know the new language. If you wanted to know karate, it would be downloaded into your brain and voila, you would know karate. They're going to sell it to you like that. They're going to sell it to you that if you have these this artificial intelligence inside of your body, that you would be able to cure your cancer, that it would find out a tumor and would eradicate it. That would be nice. If you tore your tendon in your knee, these little artificial intelligence, also known called nanobots, would be able to go there and fix your tendon in your knee. That would be nice as well, right? But there's always a price to pay for everything. What do you think that price is? That price is once you give up that sovereignty of your human body, once you give up that access to your brain, to your memories, to your dreams, to your thoughts, that it's a two-way communication, that forever, once that happens, there will be constant surveillance, constant monitoring. No, you would not have any privacy, no autonomy. They would also, they also believe that this is the way that they can create a new world, a nicer world, a world without racism, without division, because they could alter the way you behave. This sounds really crazy, I know, but just know that it is already in the works as we speak. Right now in West Africa, right this very second, these poor people are being experimented on. Who's doing it? Gavi, G-A-V-I, Bill Gates, also MasterCard and Trust Stamp, which is an artificial intelligence program. All three are doing it to the poor people. So in this program, they're giving them the COVID shots. They're also, inside the shots, it has their digital ID. That's like a barcode, like your product in the store. It can scan over your arm. They all have a number, like a cow, like chattel, like property. They also, within that digital ID on their human body, they are able to download all of their medical information and their vaccination history. And if you don't get this shot, you are locked out of the system. That means you do not get your money. They call it, in quotations, a war on cash, because they want you to be linked in with their system, which puts, gives you a number. Now, in their own words, they say that this technology with this artificial intelligence they're injecting into the people, they say that they plan to use it for surveillance, which is spying, as well as predictive policing. That's like the Tom Cruise Minority Report. This is frightening. They are admitting at this very moment their plan and intention for using the technology inside of these injections has nothing to do about making you healthy. It's not about making you a better person. It's about spying on you and doing predictive policing. Unbelievable. They are lying to everybody about the intent. Now you think, some people tell me, oh, that's just Africa. That's not going to come here. Guess again. Once it's perfected there, they said every developed nation will have that technology. And what do they call this? A wellness pass, aka a vaccine passport, guys. This is why they're pushing the injections. This is why they're trying to push the vaccine passport on everybody. We have a window of opportunity now to stop this atrocity against humankind right now. And everything starts with you and me and the person beside you, because you think that you have no power, but you do. You have amazing power in so many ways. And what I ask myself every day, and I hope you will ask yourself, is every day that I don't speak up, every day that I don't say something, what is it costing me and what is it costing the world?
So that's Dr. Carrie Madej there, speaking recently about absolutely horrific, this whole idea of human 2.0. Well, I mean, I wonder if more than half the population are just going to simply say, well, we're not having this human 2.0. The problem is, of course, that many people just simply go along with it because they think everyone else is doing it. They think, well, they don't realize, as she pointed out, there's so many of these precedents that are being set about sovereignty just simply over things like your own body. It's your body. It's not their body to tell you what to do with. Anyway, look, finally tonight, we're going to be hearing from Max Egan. I've been a fan of Max's, actually, for a long time, on and off, but mainly because of the work he did on the Christchurch Mosque Massacre. And if you haven't seen that, please do check out Max's analysis of the Christchurch Mosque Massacre, where he shows the bits and clips of the horrific Facebook Live video that the shooter was shooting as he was killing everybody at the Christchurch mosques. And there are all sorts of questions about that. One of the main ones really is that in those videos, and it's quite clear that's why the New Zealand government banned those videos, in fact made it even, apparently, even a criminal offence for journalists to possess them, to tell you what's on them, there are these figures in red directing the guy around, and Brenton Tarrant, I think, is his name. And I mean, also, of course, major thing in there is you can see he's got these Black Sun Nazi symbols on his guns that he's using to kill these poor Muslims at this horrific, horrific thing. But anyway, absolutely disgusting, of course, that the New Zealand government hasn't investigated this properly, has put out the lie that it was a lone gunman, a lone nutter. Of course, he wasn't, you know, and even then, he's putting in evidence in his video that he's obviously working as part of a group, a cult, with these Nazi Black Suns all over it. So, you know, anyway, so it was an absolutely horrific. I believe it was over 50 people were killed in that. But anyway, Max did a brilliant analysis of that, and I didn't see anyone do anything to touch it. But last Saturday, Max Egan was in Brisbane for their Freedom Rally, and what a performance he gave at that. August the 21st, 2021, over to Max Egan. And as we know, Australia is suffering some of the worst series of lockdowns in the world, and Max has risen to the occasion with this quite stirring speech.
Please welcome Mr. Max Egan to the stage.
Hello, everyone. I don't even know what day it is now. It's like day 586 or something of 14 days to flatten the curve. Soon we'll be able to say just 2 years to flatten the curve, folks. You know, what's going on here is this country's being held to ransom, folks. That's what they've done in New South Wales. They basically locked everybody into prison until they get the jab. And that's what it's all about. This is massive depopulation and it's genocide, and we are being held to ransom. So many small businesses have been closed down now. All the major corporations are making huge amounts of profit, but all of the small businesses are closing down. And the government is just doing this and squeezing and squeezing and squeezing. And they basically put in decrees to say that the only way we can keep ourselves alive is to stop living. And this virus is a quantifiable fraud. The pandemic is a quantifiable fraud. They've done all of this shit under the claim of a national emergency when the only emergency this nation faces is the out-of-control criminal government that are all in abuse of the office that they hold and all need to be told right now to get the f*** out of the building. Everybody here needs to write to every politician and say, we no longer have any confidence in your ability to govern. We are going to relinquish the privilege we gave you to govern. Get out of the building. We need to express a loss of confidence in every single politician in this country. and we need to hold them to account. There needs to be arrests because there's a crime being committed here. Abuse of office, misconduct in public office, fraud in public office. It's been supported mainly by the lying parasites and maggots in the mainstream media, these inconscionable liars who do not know the truth, do not tell the truth. You know, we used to have a media. Media was created to be the watchdog of government. Now media is the unofficial spokesperson for the criminal parasites we have masquerading as government. Because this government is not valid in any way, shape or form. It's a corporate entity and it is just criminalizing everything, folks, and it is destroying this country. So it's time we take the country back. They're shutting everything down under their guidelines, folks. They're shutting everybody down. Little bits here, little bits there. Lockdowns, release it a little bit, but leave some of it in place. Higher and higher up the chain every time, gradually squeezing everybody out of their lives and out of their businesses. So it's time we step back and we shut it all down now. The whole country, shut it down. Truckies, blockade everything. Shut down all the ports. Shut down all the highways. Shut down all the government buildings. We'll shut it down in our way. You're going to hold us to ransom. We will hold you to ransom. Because what you are doing with this medical tyranny you are rolling out over a fake virus, we've had no people die. Like people in their 90s or 80s are dying through this test, which is a PCR, which isn't a test. You can't test for anything using a PCR. A PCR is a polymerase chain reaction. It's not a test. They're ramping it up to 45 cycles. You can test anybody positive for anything you want using PCR. And that's what they've done. It's a lie. And it's a lie and a fraud being perpetrated by criminals masquerading as politicians and mainly the biggest enemy we face, which is the mainstream media. So we need to shut it all down ourselves, folks. Shut everything down. What they are doing is holding us to ransom. They're forcing people to get this jab. And the difference, the only difference between love and rape is consent. And we as Australians will not consent to this medical rape. Anastasia, pale as shit, you're in abusive office, get out of the building. Gladys Berejiklian, get out of the building. Little Danny Hunchback, get out of the buildings. We want to lead you up the gallows, mate, because that's what you deserve. Along with every police commissioner who supported this, every health officer who has supported this, every mainstream media personality who has lied to the people, we will have trials for you and we will hold you all to account and we will build the gallows ourselves if we have to. That's what it's come to, folks. So we will shut the country down under our guidelines. I've got messages from truck drivers everywhere. They're going to come to the party. We're going to shut everything down. And everybody needs to support this action. Stock up on food. Shut down all these main department stores. All these people profiting. Shut down the government buildings. Shut down the ports until the government gets out of the building. We'll approach the governor. We'll ask him for a referendum. And we will elect new government from people with integrity. These people have abdicated their privilege to govern. They have no right to any respect. They have no right to any obedience. And they are all guilty of war crimes. Genocide takes many forms, folks. And this is genocide. They're also mandating that all kids in cancer wards are going to have the jab now, folks. I know a nurse who treats cancer patients. She says every cancer patient that has come into her surgery, and they have a lot of them, every one of them who has had the jab has had massive increase in their cancer and they're all deteriorating massively. If they're going to vaccinate children in cancer wards, they are killing the children. All of these people that Brad Hazzard, the biggest threat to and hazard to health in New South Wales, Brad Hazzard, these 24,000 kids that they rounded into school and jabbed, if any of those children die, they were murdered by proxy by Brad Hazzard. The same as the man who jumped from the building in Ipswich the other day was murdered by proxy by Anastasia Palin's shit by bringing in her lockdowns and this prison society she's creating. All of these people, folks, this is a criminal enterprise. Our government, we've got to realise what's going on here. This is a war. They're holding us to ransom in order to take their poison. And they're doing it so drastically at the moment because they are freaking out that no one wants to take it. And everyone's pushing back. So like I said, they want to shut us down under their terms. So I say we shut the country down under our terms. This is our country. It's not yours. You're our employees. We're going to take it back. And you people can f*** off.
That's Egan there. A fascinating chat from him, a take on everything that's going on, the sort of thing you're never going to hear. Well, I shouldn't say never, should I? Who knows? Maybe with a decent chairman and director general, we will hear this sort of thing on the BBC again at some point. Who knows? But anyway, that's it for tonight from Brancaster Car Park, Brancaster Beach Car Park, in fact, at just on the North Norfolk coast. Near Skolt Head and Skolt Island, which we will be scooting around over the weekend and checking out for ourselves here with our little protest site in support of the Skolt Head and District Common Right Owners Association. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guests that we've had, particularly through John O'Looney, who's the funeral director. Particularly fascinating chat from him tonight, and I hope that in the MP3 podcast version that goes up, we will have a good clean version of that. Sorry about any problem that there was with you hearing that on the live broadcast, but we're going to do our very best tonight to get up as soon as we can, even though I can't really do it here from a yurt in a car park in North Norfolk, a downloadable MP3 of the show as soon as we can later tonight, and I'll put a link up to that, of course, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. My book, After 30 Years of Research into the Origins of the Bilderbergers and links back to the World War II Battle of Arnhem, portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far, is out in paperback. Well, it was a couple of months ago, actually, priced £15, including postage, on eBay. Get it. And also, if you can, the Siege of Heaven Reader, which is a look at secret government, is a whole anthology of extracts since the English Civil War about secret government. Links to both of those actual real physical books are on bilderberg.org and they're both available on eBay. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. most of the week, apart from when the Richie Allen Show is on and on the PRSC stream and over Sunday lunch at Camberley's Radio QUK.com. Thanks very much to them. Do please make live recordings of this stream. We'll be streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol next week, but this week we've been from Brancaster in Norfolk. Also, RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship, though, and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in the UK today, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, right? So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and we'll credit you here. And if you know anybody or any possible openings in the mainstream press to get this show out, to get this voice out, then I'd appreciate it too. Here is wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable bank holiday weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show, the live stream at 5 p.m. next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.